England winning the World Cup in 1966, it really did open the sluice gates to a new kind of way of England looking at itself.
60 Years of Hurt, with me, David Baddiel, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Starts on Saturday morning at 10.
This is BBC Radio 4.
It's 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 14th of May. Good morning, this is Today with Katya Adler and Justin Webb.
The headlines today: claims of an imminent leadership challenge from Wes Streeting continue to mount, despite Sir Keir Starmer meeting ministers last night to warn them a contest would plunge Labour into chaos. President Trump has promised the relationship between the United States and China will be better than ever before at the start of talks with President Xi in Beijing.
It's an honour to be with you. It's an honour to be your friend. And the relationship between China and the USA is going to be better than ever before.
And also in today's programme, Prince Harry inserts himself into the row about anti-Semitism in the UK. We'll ask why. Rivals returns to our TV screens, but the death of the author Gilly Cooper won't stop the cast partying.
Gilly wouldn't have wanted us to sit down and have a mope. She would have wanted us to continue working and have a glass of champagne afterwards, and that's exactly what we did.
And
it is going to be a long night here in Southampton. There's plenty of fallout about these spying allegations as well.
They may be known as the Saints. Are Southampton about to be punished for a sin worthy of a Le Carré novel? The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
Allies of the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, say they expect him to launch a bid to oust Sir Keir Starmer in the coming hours, despite the Prime Minister hosting a series of meetings last night to try to shore up his authority. Yesterday's state opening of Parliament was overshadowed by questions about Sir Keir's future after dozens of Labour MPs called on him to resign. He warned that a leadership contest would plunge the party into chaos, but speculation has only grown that a challenge could be imminent. Here's our political correspondent, Harry Farley.
As the Prime Minister held meetings with ministers last night, members of his cabinet were in the House of Commons tea room, warning Labour MPs a leadership election would paralyse the ability of the government to get things done for months. If Wes Streeting launches a leadership challenge today, he first needs the support of 81 Labour MPs. His opponents question whether he's reached that threshold. Another potential leadership rival, the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, has pulled out of his regular BBC Radio Manchester slot this morning. A spokesperson said he had to prioritise discussions arising from last week's elections.
Xi Jinping has told Donald Trump that the United States and China should be partners rather than rivals, as the two leaders held high-stakes talks in Beijing. They're expected to have discussed trade, Taiwan and the war in Iran. After he was greeted with a grand military parade, Mr. Trump insisted the relationship between the two powers would be better than ever before. The discussions have just finished. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker sent this report from Beijing.
The two leaders inspected lines of troops outside the Great Hall of the People before Donald Trump paused to wave to lines of cheering schoolchildren holding Chinese and American flags. Inside the hall, Mr. Xi said the world was watching and stressed that stable relations between the two sides was beneficial to all. Donald Trump wants China to buy more American goods, and he'll likely ask for President Xi's help to put pressure on Iran to end the war. China will want lower trade tariffs and may even push the US to end arms sales to Taiwan.
The Ukrainian capital has been targeted overnight in a large Russian drone attack. The mayor of Kyiv, Vitaly Klitschko, said at least 9 people had been injured, with fires breaking out in several areas of the city. The head of the Airlines Trade Association has warned that higher ticket prices for passengers in Europe are inevitable because of the high cost of jet fuel. In an interview for the BBC, Willie Walsh from the International Air Transport Association said the impact of the Iran war would be felt by the aviation industry for months to come, even if the Strait of Hormuz were to reopen tomorrow. Here's our transport correspondent, Theo Leggett.
Jet fuel prices have soared since the conflict in the Gulf began. Europe, and the UK in particular, are usually highly dependent on imports from the region, which are currently unable to get through the Strait of Hormuz. People within the industry say this has yet to have a significant impact on airfares in Europe, partly because airlines have been offering discounts in order to entice reluctant travellers. But Willie Walsh said they would be unable to absorb the extra fuel costs for long, and prices would inevitably go up. He also suggested that unless alternative sources of fuel were found, there could be shortages over the summer months, although he was confident there would not be widespread cancellations of flights.
Cuba's energy minister says the island has completely run out of oil and diesel as a US blockade continues to cut off supplies. Vicente de la Olevi said the national grid was in a critical state, with parts of the capital, Havana, going without electricity for 20 hours a day. Neither Mexico nor Venezuela, once Cuba's top suppliers, have sent fuel to the island since President Trump threatened to impose tariffs on any country breaching the blockade. Leading scientists are warning FIFA that its safety measures for heat during the Men's Football World Cup this summer are inadequate and could put players at risk of serious harm. The tournament, which is being hosted by the United States, Canada and Mexico, begins next month. The experts in health, climate and sports performance are calling on football's governing body to introduce stronger protections, including longer cooling breaks. Here's our sports correspondent, Katie Gornall.
New analysis suggests around a quarter of matches at this summer's World Cup are likely to be played in high-risk heat conditions. Plans have already been announced for mandatory 3-minute cooling breaks in each half of every match of the tournament. But the scientists believe FIFA's current measures are outdated and reckless with players' health. They're calling for longer breaks of at least 6 minutes and clearer rules to delay or postpone matches in extreme heat. FIFA says it's committed to player safety, adding that scheduling has been planned with climate in mind, including adjusted kickoff times and prioritising covered stadiums for warmer matches.
The title race in the Scottish Premiership will go down to the wire after the top two, Hearts and Celtic, both won their matches last night. Hearts beat Falkirk and a penalty in extra time gave Celtic their win against Motherwell. They'll now meet each other in the final game of the season on Saturday. The current leaders, Hearts, will be champions for the first time since 1960 if they can hold Celtic to a draw. It's a nervous wait for Hearts fans.
Of course it was going to come down to the last game. Just got to stay hopeful. This has been a horrible week leading up to this. I've been really, really nervous. And it's just extended a few more days, I suppose.
Disappointing, but I still fancy us going on Saturday. Take a draw, and I think we'll do it on Saturday. Confident.
Some anxious Hearts fans there.
Thanks so much, Jane. It's 7 minutes past six and it's time for the weather forecast with Chris at the BBC Weather Centre. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Katia. Well, looking at the weather picture today, it's another day of sunshine and heavy showers. A number of the showers will turn thundery later on this afternoon with some fairly widespread hailstorms around once again, particularly across eastern areas of the UK. Now, we start off across England and Wales with showers already streaming in across Wales, the West Midlands, South West England. We've got a few for the South Midlands and lots of showers running down eastern coastal counties into parts of Norfolk and Suffolk in East Anglia. In between and betwixt, across parts of the Midlands, northwest England, not so many showers at the moment, but they will develop later in the day. So, sunshine and showers today, a high chance of catching a downpour as we head into the afternoon. A number of the showers will turn heavy with some hail and thunder, especially across eastern counties of England and particularly for East Anglia in the southeast. So, hefty downpours, tricky travelling conditions and gusty winds, gusts into the 30s or even 40s of miles an hour with some of the storms today. Temperatures still running below average. We're looking at highs between 12 and 14 Celsius. Now for Northern Ireland, there's going to be quite a lot of cloud for western counties. We already have lots of showers in Northern Ireland too. The weather will tend to brighten up with some sunshine coming through, and it may well be that we don't see too many in the way of showers into the afternoon. So that might be one of the drier parts of the country as we go on through the afternoon. Temperature's about 10 to 14 degrees, so it's a cool day and it will be quite windy again. In Scotland, lots of showers across northern areas, but the showers become more extensive into the afternoon with hail and thunder, particularly across eastern areas. Temperatures below average, 10 to 14 degrees today. That's the latest.
Right, thank you for that. 9 minutes past six. Let us start by bringing you up to date with something that's happened in the last 10 minutes or so. So The Guardian has just published a story saying Angela Rayner has been cleared by HMRC of deliberate wrongdoing or carelessness over her tax affairs, paving the way, as The Guardian puts it, for a potential leadership bid as Keir Starmer's grip on power unravels. This is a story the paper has just published, and they have talked to Angela Rayner herself, and she indicates to them that she might run if there is a contest. She wants to play her part. She says she understands why MPs are so, Labour MPs are so upset. And she says, according to The Guardian, that Keir Starmer should reflect on stepping aside. So obviously plenty more of that still to come. The other papers that have not talked directly to Angela Rayner, or presumably to the other potential leadership candidates as well, are all anticipating a leadership bid from Wes Streeting. And soon, the Daily Mail predicts a day of anarchy ahead. Labour plunged into civil war. The Express reads, finally a move to bring down zombie Keir. The Sun chooses street fighter. The front page of the Daily Star says Downing Streeting. Get it? So Keir Starmer's allies tell the Financial Times they are sceptical, though, that the Health Secretary has the necessary backing. One of his supporters exists. Wes is a very good politician. He doesn't rely on shonky data.
A minister is quoted in The Sun as saying that Sir Keir warned that Mr Streeting will destroy Labour and the country, but Downing Street denies he said that. With the Prime Minister expected to join any contest, The Times says it'll be a three-way fight for number 10. Though The Guardian reports there's now a frantic scramble to find the candidate for the Labour left. According to the Daily Mirror, the left of the party is divided over who to choose. The Daily Telegraph predicts it will put forward the Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, because the former Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner is embroiled in an as-yet unresolved tax row, although you've brought us up to date with that, Justin. It does quote, though, the paper, one figure on the left saying that Angela Rayner is well-liked but a complete liability.
Allies of Andy Burnham tell the iPaper that he will try to join the fight, saying he's found a seat, but it might not be winnable. According to the Mail, they're lobbying for an extended timetable to any leadership contest. The paper, though, says any delay could leave the UK with a lame-duck Prime Minister. A supporter of Mr Burnham, quoted in the Telegraph, admits he'll probably be squeezed out of the race. One MP backing the Greater Manchester Mayor tells The Guardian he has run out of time. Another says his best hope now is to do a deal with Sir Keir.
In its leader column, the FT insists that what it terms the battle for the soul of Labour shouldn't be a drawn-out process. It warns that the UK finds itself in a moment of great peril, and it calls for Labour to remember the principle of country first and party second.
It is 12 minutes past six.
A lot of pomp and a lot of pageantry greeted President Trump, and he seemed to like it as he met China's President Xi for their much-anticipated high-stakes summit in Beijing. Now, before talks began, President Trump spoke of the significance of this summit.
There are those that say this is maybe the biggest summit ever. They can never remember anything like it. It's, I can say in the United States, it's people aren't talking about anything else. But it's an honor to be with you. It's an honor to be your friend. And the relationship between China and the USA is going to be better than ever before.
Well, the world's two most powerful leaders have just finished their meeting, which lasted about 2 hours. That's double the time scheduled. Laura Bicker, our China correspondent, can tell us more. Hello, Laura.
Hello, hello. Yes, the two leaders have just actually arrived now at the Temple of Heaven. This is this 15th century sacrificial altar where emperors used to go to pray for a good harvest. And obviously, you know, many of us are kind of looking, wondering exactly what these two leaders have agreed in those 2 hours. But it does seem that China will buy more American goods, particularly agricultural products, from American soybeans to American beef. So that's one thing we know is on the agenda, as well as, of course, Donald Trump bought that entourage of CEOs, including NVIDIA chief. So we're wondering whether or not America will agree to sell advanced computer chips to China so that it can fuel its robotics revolution that President Xi is pushing forward.
Because that's what's so interesting, isn't it? Because President Xi, before the talk, said we should be partners but not rivals. But clearly they're rivals.
Clearly they're rivals. I mean, Donald Trump built up a political brand by talking tough on China, and then today he lavished praise on his host as he sat across from President Xi. He also appeared to be wowed by the precision of this military honour guard. It was a real ceremonial welcome outside the Great Hall of the People. I mean, even the eyes of the troops, they carefully tracked the two leaders on the red carpet. And he enjoyed the adoration of the Chinese children waving and cheering ahead of the summit. In fact, he paused twice to say hello. Now, China will not be immune to the effect of this flattery, but also China believes the balance of power is shifting in their favour. They see a war-weakened Donald Trump, and I think that's where they'll push forward for their wants, their needs during this summit.
Laura Becker, thank you very much.
It is 14 minutes past six. We still don't know the identity of the three women who died in the sea off Brighton. Their bodies found yesterday morning. Let's talk to Lee Milner, the BBC's correspondent, who's there in Brighton. What are the police saying? What more are the police saying, Lee, about this?
Good morning, Justin. Apart from the
fact that the three bodies were found?
Huge impact here in Brighton. Police have confirmed that the bodies of three young women were recovered from the sea yesterday morning. It was about this time, actually, about 5:45 in the morning, when concerns were raised about someone in the water near Madeira Drive. Now, just to explain where Madeira Drive is, it's the long stretch that runs right across the seafront. I'm currently standing on Madeira Drive. I can see Brighton Pier on my right. The Coast Guard has now ended its search. What we know at the moment is that the women haven't yet been formally identified, but officers believe that they were aged between 20 and 30. At this stage, obviously, their priority is identifying who they are so that they can contact their families. For anybody who knows Brighton Beach, though, as you go into the water, it's quite steep. There's a sudden drop. Also, here during this time of the year, the current can be quite strong. And I can tell you now, it's very, very cold. It's 6 degrees. So the water would have been extremely cold when this incident happened. Police say it's still very early days in the investigation, and they are urging people not to speculate. There's been lots of speculation online, but they are trying to find out what exactly happened. One of the lines of inquiry includes whether the women may have entered the sea from the beach before getting into difficulty.
Lee Milner in Brighton. Thank you.
It is 16 minutes past six. More on the Donald Trump visit to China. We've had warm words so far, but what about the actual meeting? What impact could it have on global trade after this turbulent year of tariffs? Sean Farrington's here with more and the rest of the business news. Sean.
Morning, Katia. Yeah, so NVIDIA, we've had the NVIDIA boss, Jensen Huang, who's on the trip saying he hopes that Trump and Xi will build on their wonderful relationship. And we've heard in the last 20 minutes or so that President Xi now meeting with US business leaders after those talks you were talking to Laura about. President Xi saying China's door will only open wider to American businesses. American firms will have broader prospects in the country. How does that play out for those already trading between the two countries? Jacob Rothman is president and chief executive at the China-based Velong Enterprises, cooking accessories manufacturer, so exports to the likes of Walmart in America, Tesco and Sainsbury's here as well. You might be familiar with the Joseph and Joseph brands or OXO accessories that they make. Jacob, morning. Thank you for your time.
Morning. Thank you for having me on.
Do these warm words that we've heard tally with what it's been like making things in China and selling them to the US in recent years?
Not exactly. I mean, we've been dealing with this for essentially 9 years. And whereas I was really happy to see both presidents communicate warmly together, and it's still is doubtful to change what's going on in the manufacturing landscape in a great way.
What has been going on?
So since President Trump's first term, manufacturing has been slowly moving from China, where the majority of it has been for decades, to other countries. We were first to, in the wave of that to go to Cambodia, then to Thailand, then to India. And it's been this slow sort of development of manufacturing, building resources outside of China and serving customers.
Do you detect that China wants that to change? Does it want you to be making more of your stuff in China rather than those other countries around Asia?
Yes, I'm sure they would, and we would like to. We're a Chinese company. I never imagined coming here 20 years ago that I would be operating in four different countries. And it's not a lot of fun to try to manage a global supply chain like that. But unfortunately, the products that we make, or fortunately, are not really the targets. The targets, as you can see, I was left off the delegation to go to Beijing. I make specialists. I don't make more important products that are AI and technology related.
Well, people might see those spatulas in their kitchens a bit more than they actually see those semiconductors in the tech all around their homes. I just wonder, Jacob, the prices that we see on our shelves in the UK, are you expecting them to be increasing this year? And if so, by how much?
Yeah, that's a difficult question. And I think many people, whether they're manufacturers or buyers on the other side, it depends really on what type of products that you make. But because of what's going on in the Strait of Hormuz, it makes it difficult, particularly when petroleum goes up, plastic prices go up. I could give you round numbers of between 7 to 15%, but that really depends on where the product's being made. In which country is India or China or somewhere in Southeast Asia going to be able to absorb that through other inputs like labor or raw material availability?
Could these talks ease those price increases somehow?
Well, I hope so. I mean, the thing that I'm hoping that happens is there's some resolution on how to handle Iran and the Straits of Hormuz, because that would allow petroleum prices to decrease and plastics, which is a commodity we use quite a bit. So I hope that's an output, one outcome of this. I also hope there's a better relationship between my home country, the United States, and China. That would be amazing for us and our customers in the United States. But for people like Tesco or Sainsbury's, like you mentioned, they've been diversifying outside of China for decades, not decades, for the last couple of years at least, and very serious about it recently. So I think pricing and the talks won't necessarily affect the UK specifically, but the US for sure.
Jacob, thank you for your time this morning. Jacob Rothman, the President and Chief Executive at the China-based Velong Enterprises, making those cooking accessories. Let's talk a little bit more about what's been going on with the oil, with Lucy Coutts, JM Finn's Investment Director. Lucy, good morning. I mean, barrel of Brent crude, still around $106 a barrel this morning. It feels sort of steadier, but the headlines are more about inventories depleting at a record pace.
They are. So obviously, as a consequence of reduced flows across the world, then people are drawing from their inventories and quite right at multi-year lows. I mean, we estimate that the cumulative supply losses are at the hundreds of millions of barrels, and any physical restock is going to take weeks. We have to sort of, in context, remember that these oil tankers move at a very speedy 14 miles an hour crossing the world's seas. So as the Strait of Hormuz has suffered closure and many fewer ships coming through that area, then there is going to be a natural lag in that supply. So at the moment, we're in this false sense of security that the supply is still coming through.
Well, America's trying to step up. Donald Trump said, just buy our oil. Can they keep that up?
They can. They're very lucky. Their geography permits them to be very self-sufficient, and they have a huge strategic oil reserve. And Biden, formerly, and Trump both use it in periods of stress. And I think last month Trump drew 170 million barrels. But what you have to remember is that strategic reserve is crude oil, so it still needs to be refined. It still needs to be go through that production process. It's not an instant fix.
Lucy, thank you. Lucy Coutts there from JM Finn. We've been watching the oil price a lot in recent months now. A lot of attention has turned to the bond prices, and particularly the cost of borrowing for the UK government, the effective cost of borrowing for the UK government. So over a 10-year period, those 10-year gilts, that interest rate, that yield, fell a little bit to 5.05%, but still above that 5% level. Many have been keeping an eye on levels that we haven't really seen for quite some time. Luke Hickmore is an investment director in fixed income at Aberdeen, very much keeps a close eye on all of this. And Luke, morning. With all the political goings on now, what are the big questions for those bond investors that lend money to governments like the UK?
Yeah, morning, Sean. Interesting listening to your previous guests and talking about supply of oil.
we have no troubles with supply of government bonds. $300 billion a year the UK government is borrowing at the moment. And that is what makes this so important. And whatever happens with the politics, whether we go left, we go right, we go centrist, what we've not seen is any real stability on policies, any long-term planning. And quite honestly, investors in gilts, in UK government bonds, are saying, we're not sure what the future looks like, which means the risk is higher. We don't know what's going to be happening with the fiscal plans of these governments, which means the risk is higher, and that pushes up the cost of borrowing. Add in oil, add in Iran conflict, add in a pretty weak economy in the UK. It's an ugly picture, Sean.
Some of the conversation has been if the politics goes more to the left and there's more sort of inclination for higher spending and tax rises that might come with that, that might be the thing. But am I right in saying, from what you're saying, it doesn't necessarily, it's not necessarily about those kind of policies themselves, or would that have an impact?
It certainly would. But as I said, I think it's around this short-termism we're seeing a lot in UK politics at the moment. You know, how long does a PM last? How long does a Chancellor last? How long does the government last? These things are more existential and more problematic, I think. However, you know, the FT wrote an excellent article this week talking about the bond market acting as police on political parties in the UK. So even if we do move left, I think there's a realisation that you can't keep pushing on the fiscal side and expect your cost of borrowing to stay the same. So I think that's important, but perhaps it's more about we need longer term stability than a left or a right or a centrist government.
Luke Hickmore, Investment Director at Aberdeen. Thank you for your time this morning. Let's just have a quick look at what's going on. This multi-million pound deal between HMRC, the department in charge of collecting taxes, and a big tech company, British company called Quantexa, have described themselves as a decision intelligence firm. They've got this £175 million contract with HMRC, 10-year one, to overhaul its data systems. Vishal Maria is the founder and chief executive of Quantexa. Vishal, good morning. How much of a game changer is this for HMRC? What actual changes are going to come about because of it?
Good morning, Sean, and great to be on this morning. So since I started Quantexa in 2016, our mission, Sean, has been to help organisations connect fragmented data so they can make better, faster and more trusted decisions. For HMRC, that means helping creating a clearer picture across all of its fragmented systems so they can improve customer service, identify fraud earlier, and support more informed decision making. As you say, Sean, this is a landmark deal for the government and for Quantexa, and it represents one of the largest public sector decision intelligence and data transformation programs that the public sector, in this case HMRC, is executing today.
And what does that mean for, you know, is this going to be a cost reduction for HMRC? Does it mean they need to have fewer people working there?
So the benefits of the program will be multifold. So first thing, on the taxpayer, on the customer itself, better decisioning. If a taxpayer has accidentally routed their tax return to the wrong reference number, you and I probably have done that in the past. How do we get that information quicker to the agents at HMRC so they can rectify those problems?
But in your experience, Vishal, and this isn't me, you know, I'm not sort of saying the blame goes on you for creating this technology, but in your experience, when people use your technology, do you see that one of the efficiency savings they make is headcount?
So we've deployed our platform in multi-industries, banking, government, insurance, and so on. What I've seen so far is that we haven't seen a reduction in headcount, but what we have seen is an enablement and a productivity increase. So where someone was doing three or four things, they're now doing five or six things. And more importantly, they're doing it more effectively with better trust and better accuracy.
And Vishal, just briefly, given the world you are working in, are you sort of eyeing up, preparing for potential bid for NHS contracts that might become available?
So we work right across government, if that's in tax, border security, defence, intelligence, as well as the healthcare. Now, as you all know, and many have asked me over the last few days, weeks, We did enter the Federated Data Platform program in the NHS, and we did incredibly well to come second. Now, as my dear old mum said, you get no prizes for coming second.
Okay.
But we're fully focused in working and supporting the government in any large-scale program.
Vishal Maria, founder of Quantexa, thank you for your time.
Sean, thank you. 28 minutes past six. To the sport, here is Jane Dougal. Morning, Jane.
Good morning, Justin. VAR could have influenced the outcome of the Scottish Premiership after Celtic were awarded a controversial late penalty against Motherwell, ensuring that the title race will go to a final day decider. League leaders Hearts convincingly beat Falkirk 3-0 last night. But Celtic's 3-2 victory away at Motherwell came after they scored a 99th minute penalty following a contentious handball decision. Hearts remain 1 point ahead of Celtic and now have to win or draw this Saturday at Parkhead in order to be Scottish champions. Head coach Derek McInnes says he was confused by the penalty decision.
Kept watching it and kept watching. I'm thinking, am I missing something here? It's a strange decision considering the big decisions we didn't get. You know, whether it was two penalties for us at the weekend at Motherwell, or certainly one. So that's what it is. We feel as if we're up against everybody. That's where we feel. Siege mentality. We just need to do what we need to do for our club. Turn up on Saturday.
A return to form for Phil Foden helped Manchester City beat Crystal Palace to ensure the Premier League title race continues into the final week of the campaign. Foden set up the first two goals in City's 3-0 victory, leaving Pep Guardiola's side trailing leaders Arsenal by 2 points with two games to go. Rory McIlroy says he is no longer in pain after losing a toenail ahead of the second major of the year. A switch of footwear has helped the Masters champion as he prepares to compete at the US PGA Championship at Aronimink near Philadelphia. Our golf correspondent Ian Carter has more.
McIlroy came through 9 holes of practice yesterday, saying he was pleasantly surprised at how comfortable his troublesome right foot felt. He's using wider fitting golf shoes to alleviate the discomfort he's feeling from a blistered right little toe. On Tuesday, he had to cut short a practice round after just 3 holes. Today, he tees off early with John Rahm and Jordan Spieth. The defending champion, Scottie Scheffler, is the favourite after finishing runner-up in his last 3 events, and he plays alongside 2 Englishmen, Justin Rose and the in-form Matt Fitzpatrick.
Former wicketkeeper Sarah Taylor will be England men's fielding coach during the upcoming Test series against New Zealand, making her the first woman to coach an England men's side in a major sport. She'll be working with a new-look squad that includes Durham's Emilio Gay, who'll open the batting, and seam bowler Ollie Robinson, who's been recalled after a 2-year absence. And the second one-day international between England women and New Zealand at Northampton was a washout, with play abandoned without a ball being bowled. The 3-match series continues at Cardiff on Saturday.
Thank you, Jane. It's 31 minutes past six. And next week on Radio 4, a drama that breathes new life into the women who transformed British horticulture.
Will you promise me something? Love differently.
I promise.
The stories of Gertrude Jekyll, Ellen Wilmot and Beatrix Potter.
You are not above the garden. You are of it.
Do not wait for permission.
And never apologise.
3 female horticulturalists who chose to resist convention, redraw boundaries and follow their passion.
When you look up at the night sky, I shall be there.
Featuring Juliet Stevenson.
What survives is to have made something honest.
Trimorous. 3 Heroines Unearthed begins next Tuesday afternoon at 2:15 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Time now is 28 minutes to 7. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Katya Adler, Justin Weyman, Jane Steele with the news.
Supporters of the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, say they expect him to challenge the Prime Minister for the Labour leadership in the coming hours. Last night, Keir Starmer held meetings with Labour MPs and ministers, warning that a leadership contest would plunge the government into chaos. It's unclear if Mr. Streeting has the support of 81 MPs required for a challenge. The former Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, has told The Guardian newspaper that she's been cleared by HMRC over her tax affairs. She resigned last September after admitting she'd underpaid stamp duty on her flat in Hove. This morning, Ms. Rayner has said she would not make a pact with Andy Burnham in any potential leadership challenge. President Xi Jinping has told Donald Trump that China and the US should be partners, not rivals, during their summit in Beijing. President Trump said their relationship would be better than ever before. It's thought they discussed trade, competition over technology, Taiwan and the Iran war. Officials in Kyiv say one person has been killed and 16 others were injured in heavy Russian drone and missile attacks on the city overnight. Rescue teams are trying to pull survivors from the rubble of a residential building that was hit. The Ukrainian military says the country was targeted by at least 900 drones in the last 24 hours. Air travellers in Europe have been warned that flights will inevitably become more expensive because the Iran war has pushed up the price of jet fuel dramatically. The head of the International Air Transport Association, Willie Walsh, says at the moment companies are absorbing the additional cost, but over time ticket prices will have to go up. Leading scientists has warned FIFA that its safety measures for heat during the Men's Football World Cup in North America this summer are inadequate and could put players at risk of serious harm. They say three-minute cooling breaks are too short and should last at least 6 minutes, and there should be clearer rules to delay or postpone matches in extreme heat.
Thank you for that. Just coming up to, 25 to 7, and just half an hour or so ago, The Guardian reported that Angela Rayner had been cleared of wrongdoing by HMRC, clearing the way for her to take part in a leadership contest, if indeed she wants to. She tells The Guardian that Keir Starmer should reflect on stepping aside. All of this, of course, before Wes Streeting, the health secretary, says anything about his own position, although that is certainly expected in the coming hours. Angela Rayner has been talking to Paul Brand on ITV News. She was asked what she thought of the speculation that Wes Streeting might challenge the Prime Minister.
You know, that's Wes Streeting's choice. And, you know, that if he's got the support and people are going forward, then that's up to Wes. I've said that I would not trigger the Prime Minister, and I want to make sure that we bring the party together. I understand at the moment that there are these questions that are being legitimately asked.
Let's talk to Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, who is already in Downing Street. Henry, this is quite an important development, isn't it?
It's likely to be a day of quite important developments, Justin, but this is a very important one to begin with. Just on the facts, of course, because this was the thing that precipitated Angela Rayner's departure from government as Deputy Prime Minister back in September. And she, according to her interviews this morning, has paid £40,000 in unpaid stamp duty to HMRC, but has not had to pay a penalty. But then, yes, crucially, what does this mean for the Labour leadership contest, which is widely expected to be initiated by Wes Streeting, the health secretary, today? Well, it means that what was a major obstacle, in fact, the major obstacle in the minds of certain MPs, particularly on the soft left of the Labour Party, to an Angela Rayner candidacy, has been cleared, and cleared with incredibly fortuitous timing from her part.
Mm. Meanwhile, what's happening with Wes Streeting? Because the briefing from 10 Downing Street was that he'd bottled it, and it had failed already, his attempted coup, if indeed there was going to be an attempted coup. But we are now, are we expecting that he hasn't bottled it, he's going to do something today?
Look, we don't know, but I do know that it is the widespread expectation of some of his closest allies and staunchest supporters, as well as, though this is perhaps slightly less relevant, his most fervent enemies, that Wes Streeting is going to launch a challenge for the Labour leadership today. I mean, he's marched so far up the hill that it's kind of hard to see how he doesn't do so at this point. I think the more open question is whether, if when he launches that leadership bid, he has the requisite support. He needs the support of 80 fellow MPs to get to the number required to trigger a ballot of Labour Party members. Now, a number far larger than that, or a fair bit larger than that, has called for Sir Keir Starmer to go, and a number even larger than that has failed to back Sir Keir Starmer staying. But that group of people is pretty split on what should come next and who should come next. So it's not a given that Wes Streeting would have the support of all of them. Some of his most natural supporters are still in the cabinet or still in the government ranks, and therefore publicly but also in many cases privately, as far as I can tell, backing Sir Keir Starmer, believing now is not the right time for a leadership contest. It would be fascinating to see the extent to which that might change just over the course of this morning, let alone the next few days.
Yeah, and of course plenty of those who think now is not the right time are supporters of the Mayor of Greater Manchester, aren't they, and Andy Burnham, who, again, rumours that he has now found someone who's willing to step down so that he could get a parliamentary seat, a common seat.
On Friday, some of Andy Burnham's closest allies told me he had a dead cert plan for a seat that would be unveiled soon. On Saturday, some of Andy Burnham's closest allies told me that he had a nailed-on plan for a seat that would be unveiled soon. On Sunday, I mean, you get the idea, Justin. I think in the minds of some of those Labour MPs who are open to backing Andy Burnham, and they are numerous and they span factional divisions of the Labour Party, it's not just on the left, in their minds, today is the day for Andy Burnham to make good on that suggestion that he does indeed have a seat. There are all sorts of rumours, but whenever one of the rumours gets to us and other journalists, we put it to the MP who is sitting in that seat at the moment, and they deny that it is them who has agreed to give up a seat to Andy Burnham. Look, there's a few ifs here stacked upon each other, but if Wes Streeting does initiate a Labour leadership contest today, and if Andy Burnham then does not pretty rapidly make clear that he has a way of getting into Parliament, then I think for a chunk of the Labour Party, certainly lots of people I've spoken to, the conversation is going to turn to who might be their candidate instead of Andy Burnham. And I think given the news with which we started this discussion, it seems more likely than it did yesterday that Angela Rayner will be one of the people to whom many minds will turn.
All right, and it's a discussion that will carry on during the course of the programme. Obviously, Henry Zeffman, for the time being, thank you. We'll be talking to James Murray, the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, at 8:10.
It's 7:20, and the Health Ministry in Lebanon says that 22 people died, including 8 children, when Israel intensified strikes on the country yesterday. And that is ahead of a new round of direct negotiations between Lebanon and Israel, brokered by the United States. Hugo Bashega is BBC Middle East correspondent and in Beirut for us. Hello, Hugo.
Morning.
Good morning. Now, President Trump announced a ceasefire in Lebanon about a month ago. That's not how it's looked on the ground pretty much ever since. And what is the latest overnight, can you tell us?
Yeah, so it was a particularly violent day yesterday, as you've just mentioned, and those Israeli airstrikes continued overnight in the city of Tyre in the south. One of the targets was a residential neighborhood. A number of people were injured in that attack. And Israel says it is targeting Hezbollah infrastructure, Hezbollah members, but what we're seeing here is that many civilians are being killed, children, women, medical workers, and these attacks happen every day, day and night. So there's a lot of frustration here in Lebanon, obviously, because a lot of people here feel that the ceasefire first, it's a deal that is one-sided because it gives Israel the right to continue to attack, claiming self-defense. The way the deal is worded essentially gives Israel the right to attack anything, anyone, and this is exactly what is happening. And Hezbollah has been responding, has been attacking Israel, Israeli troops that continue to occupy parts of southern Lebanon, a no-go zone for the residents in that part of the country. So in southern Lebanon in particular, the war continues, and this is a ceasefire in name only.
And but there are these new talks now, aren't there, between Israel and the Lebanese government. How much hope is there amongst people in Lebanon, so many of whom have been killed in this latest round of violence, so many displaced from their homes, and Hezbollah against these talks?
Yeah, I think there's very little hope that we could see something significant emerging from these talks. I think it's positive that for the very first time in a very long time, a U.S. administration seems to be giving a lot of attention to the situation in Lebanon. There's a lot of pressure from U.S. officials for some kind of deal that could normalize relations between Israel and Lebanon. But it is a very difficult position for the Lebanese government. First, they're having to engage with this process while the country is being attacked. Civilians, as you say, are being killed. The country is under occupation. This is a very controversial issue here in Lebanon. But obviously at the center of this problem, if you like, is the issue of Hezbollah's weapons. This is something the government cannot deliver. The president here has been saying this cannot be done by force, that there needs to be a diplomatic process that includes Hezbollah. And obviously Hezbollah is not being involved in these talks and has refused to disarm. So how do you square the circle? Nobody seems to know.
Indeed. Hugo Bechega in Beirut, thank you.
It is 17 minutes to 7. Let's have a brief look at what the papers are saying this morning because, well, it is interesting and particularly interesting from The Guardian, which I'll get to in a second. But first of all, the headlines that really suggest that West Streeting, as we're hearing from Henry Zeffman, is going to say something today about his future. And indeed, it would be pretty odd if he didn't. Streeting set to resign, will challenge PM, says The Eye. Streeting on manoeuvres, says the early edition of The Guardian. Starmer allies, Starmer rallies Labour loyalists in move to see off Streeting, says the Financial Times. Streeting prepares to quit ahead of number 10 challenge. You get the picture. But all of them rather scooped by The Guardian this morning, which published a story, three quarters of an hour or so ago, in which they say that Angela Rayner has been cleared by HMRC of deliberate wrongdoing or carelessness over her tax affairs. And that, they say, paves a way for a potential leadership bid from her as Keir Starmer's grip on power, as they put it, unravels. And she's told the paper that she might run if there is a contest. She wants to play her part, she says. She understands why Labour MPs are so upset following the election, the local elections, and indeed the elections in Scotland and Wales. But she also says Keir Starmer should reflect on stepping aside. So that was that's what is on the front page, at least in the digital version of The Guardian. And plainly, Ms. Rayner is up and about and talking to people. Indeed, if she wants to talk to us, she'd be very welcome to come on. We will create the space. And the same goes for Wes Streeting, almost certainly is also listening right now. Either of them very welcome on the programme to join our discussions over the next couple of hours. Now, at 7:15, speculation about Sir Keir Starmer's future was put on hold for just a few short hours yesterday. The King came to Westminster for the state opening of Parliament and set out the government's plans for new laws. So let us turn to Alicia McCarthy, who was watching it all.
As is traditional with the state opening of Parliament, there was a bit of this. And a bit of this. And a bit of this. But it didn't take long for the first hint that all was not quite normal in the state of Westminster.
Not her, Andy!
One rogue MP shouting out that now was not the moment for the Greater Manchester Mayor and possible Labour leadership contender Andy Burnham to make his return to the Commons. Back down the corridor, the King read out the speech prepared for him by ministers, outlining the more than 35 bills the government wants to turn into law in the next year or so. But the question consuming Westminster was who would be in charge of that government. At the start of the debate on the plans, the Conservative leader turned straight to the uncertainty swirling around Sir Keir Starmer.
This King's speech is taking place against the most extraordinary backdrop. We knew the carriages were booked, the horses were ready, the King was coming, but would we have a Prime Minister?
Kemi Badenoch accused Labour of trying to tackle the problems of the past instead of dealing with the UK's current challenges, and argued what plans the government had amounted to a load of re-announced policies. One in Wes Streeting's department in particular had caught her eye.
Scrapping NHS England, something the Prime Minister announced 14 months ago. But then I suppose the Health Secretary has been a bit distracted lately, hasn't he? Yeah, hasn't he? Yeah. He's chuntering now. Why don't you just do your job? Do your job.
Where, Kemi Badenoch asked, were the ideas to reform benefits or cut spending or help businesses? And she called it preposterous that the government was setting out plans for new laws as ministers were resigning and Labour MPs were saying Keir Starmer should go.
Either Labour MPs agree with this agenda, in which case, why are they trying to get rid of the Prime Minister? Or they don't agree with this agenda, in which case, what on earth are we all doing here? Yeah.
Well, Labour MPs who'd sat through the Conservative leader's attack might have been a touch surprised when the Prime Minister began his reply by thanking her with a little smile.
In difficult days, her input is always a ray of sunshine. I particularly getting tips from her on how to win friends.
Bills in the speech will make changes, among other things, to policing and education, immigration and asylum, and the UK's relationship with Europe. And Keir Starmer insisted this King's speech was different.
It is an agenda of radical reform across our major public services. An urgent activist Labour government that tilts power back to workers, renters and the less fortunate. Gives voice to the working class and to all those that the status quo has repeatedly ignored and dismissed.
The Lib Dem leader, Sir Ed Davey, reckoned the vote at the end of the debate on the King's speech next week could be interesting.
We will be voting against this King's speech, Mr. Speaker, but how many members opposite will? By my reckoning, if every Labour MP who's called for the Prime Minister to go voted that way, this government's huge majority would be at risk. Let's see if they have the courage of their convictions.
Dave Dugan has taken over as the SNP's Westminster leader after Stephen Flynn was elected to the Scottish Parliament last week. He wasn't impressed by what he'd heard.
They've got a majority that would choke a horse. They've been preparing for government for 14 years. And yet they come in and you think, it's like they just landed here.
Reform UK's deputy leader Richard Tice said Keir Starmer was possibly Britain's worst ever Prime Minister.
And we have a programme of government in this King's speech that in a sense represents everything that this Prime Minister currently that we suffer under represents. Process and regulation.
MPs and peers will continue to debate the speech well into next week, whatever the rest of Westminster may be up to.
That was Alicia McCarthy, and it's coming up to 10 minutes to 7. The Metropolitan Police has warned it's preparing for potential violence and hate speech crimes across two protests in London this Saturday. More than 4,000 officers will be drafted to police the events, and it's thought to be one of the largest protest deployments in decades. And that is because of fears that demonstrators at the Unite the Kingdom event organised by the anti-Islam activist Stephen Yaxley Lennon, better known as Tommy Robinson, as well as the annual Nakba Day pro-Palestinian protests in another part of central London, could clash if they are not kept apart. Well, Dad Babu is former chief superintendent of the Metropolitan Police, and he's a member of the London Policing Board. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Katia.
Now, yesterday, the Deputy Assistant Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, James Harman, said this Saturday has the potential to be one of the busiest days for policing in recent years. It sounds like a bit of an understatement. You've also got tens of thousands of football fans. They're expected at Wembley Stadium on Saturday for the FA Cup final. That's going to add further pressure, surely. So what specific challenges are you looking out for there that will be facing your officers, and what specific plans have you got to manage them?
Well, I think this is a huge event. We have 4,000 police officers on duty. The key thing is to ensure that the two demonstrations are kept apart. They have a scheduled route, and it's important to keep them on those routes. But we know from previous demonstrations there have been allegations of anti-Muslim comments and from the Tommy Robinson group, and there are comments of accusations of anti-Semitism from the pro-Palestinian. So I think the police will have their hands full. As you said, on top of that, they have the FA Cup final. So they have 90,000 fans travelling to that event as well. So it's going to be an incredibly challenging day, but I think the police are well prepared. The key thing will be to make sure that they're able to talk to the organisers and ensure that they keep to the routes that have been prescribed.
Well, you mentioned their fears of potential hate speech in both of the protests. Hate speech conditions have been imposed on organisers, but how does that work in practice?
Well, in practice, when you've got potentially tens of thousands, maybe more on each demonstrations, then the police have to police those particular events. They can be quite challenging to make arrests at the time. The police will have extensive facial recognition cameras out there. Well, they'll have drones out. They'll have CCTV cameras, and officers are with body-worn footage. So they will gather evidence. It may be more challenging to make the arrests at the time. So they may be able to do that. But if they don't make the arrest at the time, they'll use that evidence to subsequently review the video footage and then make arrests.
Right. So, and it's the first major use of facial recognition cameras as part of a policing operation, as far as I understand. Because of these fears, I mean, obviously, you know, you really are preparing here. There have been calls for either one or both of the protests to be banned. When and under what conditions can police stop a march?
Well, in the last 40 years, Katia, there's only been two demonstrations that have been stopped. It's when there's concerns about serious public disorder. And with all the resources that the police have, it would be very, very difficult to justify stopping a march because of serious public disorder. So the police are able to manage these demonstrations. I think the difficulty will be if we have splinter groups or you have individuals who are determined to cause violence, that would be very challenging for the police to manage. But with 4,000 police officers on duty, with all the additional resources that they have, the police are confident that they'll be able to manage these two demonstrations and keep everybody safe.
Dal Babu, former Chief Superintendent of the Metropolitan Police and current member of the London Policing Board, thank you.
6 minutes to seven is the time. An online forum that encourages suicide has been fined nearly £1 million. It is a first, but campaigners are calling for more. Andy Burrows is on the line, who's the CEO of the Molly Rose Foundation. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And you welcomed, do you, at least the fine?
We welcome the fine, and we welcome Ofcom having finally taken the necessary action. What is deeply regrettable, though, Justin, is that it has taken 13 months to arrive at what should have been a clear-cut set of findings.
Why did it take so long?
It's a very good question. Now, Ofcom has said that this is the first major investigation like this that they've run. But frankly, it has felt all the way along like it has been beholden on civil society groups and on bereaved families to insist that Ofcom continue with this investigation. At one point, it looked like they were actually going to put the investigation on hold. And it really characterises this risk aversion, which is what we've seen consistently from the way that Ofcom is enforcing the Online Safety Act. But we should be really clear, this forum is nihilistic. It exists for one primary purpose, to groom vulnerable people into taking their own lives. And we know that this site has been linked to at least 164 deaths in the UK and very probably many more.
Would you like to see criminal prosecutions if such prosecutions were feasible?
Yes, absolutely. Because the reality is that this is not a standard technology company. The normal rules just don't apply in this case. We need to see decisive action that can bring the appalling perpetrators behind this forum to account, but can also then send a very clear message to anyone who might be minded to set up pop-up sites or mirror sites that this is not something that the UK will tolerate. This is a matter of public safety, of targeting some of the most vulnerable people in this country today.
Is it your understanding now? I want to be careful about drawing people's attention to it too much, but is it your understanding now that the forum is closed, will be closed? How much damage, realistically, does this Ofcom action do to it?
Well, we think that fines are important because that is what can send a clear disincentive to the individuals running this forum, that if they continue to operate it, then, you know, look, essentially they could face bankruptcy given the level of the fine. Regrettably, the forum does exist. It's why we don't name it, and we're not naming it during this interview. But it is, frankly, deeply problematic. Firstly, that it's taken so long to see this action being brought, but also we are seeing clear-cut breaches today from search engines, the like of Google and Bing. And if you search for this forum by name, it will still come up in search results. A clear-cut breach of the Act. But on that matter, Ofcom has so far declined to take action.
Andy Burrows, CEO of the Molly Rose Foundation. Thank you.
On BBC Sounds, there are podcasts to help you look after your body
and your mind.
From increasing your immunity
to feeling more confident.
Or tips on how to focus.
Sorry, what were you saying?
If it matters to you, it matters to us.
Feel good inside and out.
With What's Up Docs
and Complex with Kimberly Wilson.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
It's just then 2 minutes to seven. Time for the weather forecast with Chris Fawkes. Let the sun shine on us, please, Chris.
Yes, but the sunshine will make showers, Katia. Every day we get showers, you need a certain trigger temperature to make the clouds start to rise. And today, that trigger temperature is really low for summer. We only need temperatures to get past 8 degrees Celsius, which we'll see those temperatures nationwide today. And that's why we're going to see showers pretty much popping up absolutely anywhere, some of them turning heavy with hail and thunder later on today. So weather-wise this morning, we've already got lots of showers across Wales, southwest England, eastern counties of England, there are a few in the Midlands, lots for Northern Ireland and lots across northern areas of Scotland. Those showers are there because, of course, sea temperatures are above 8 degrees, which is why the showers are already forming and moving into the coastal areas. As we go through the day, temperatures rise past the 8 degree mark, showers break out just about anywhere, heavy with hail and thunder, particularly so for parts of eastern Scotland and eastern coastal counties of England, and I suspect some of the heaviest downpours will be across East Anglia in the southeast come the latter part of the afternoon, but nowhere is immune from a hefty downpour. Tricky travelling conditions with those showers coming down. They'll also have gusty winds, and the showers will also dump temperatures by about 5 degrees Celsius in the matter of 5 or 10 minutes, so it will turn quite cold when those showers do work through. We've got gusty winds with gusts of around 30 to 40 miles an hour today, particularly across western areas, but also from some of those beefier showers. Our temperatures remain well below average, 10 to 15 degrees Celsius. Looking at the forecast tomorrow, it is another showery day, but there'll be fewer showers around, more in the way of sunshine, so you have a slightly higher chance of staying dry and dodging the downpours tomorrow than is the case today.
Chris, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Katja Adler and Justin Webb.
It's 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 14th of May. Good morning. The headlines this morning. The former Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, says she's been cleared by HMRC over her tax affairs, removing a major obstacle to her standing in any potential leadership contest against Sir Keir Starmer. Allies of Wes Streeting say his challenge to the Prime Minister could come within hours. In the next hour, we'll hear from Tracy Brabin, the Labour Mayor of West Yorkshire, who yesterday visited Downing Street to give her advice to Keir Starmer. And President Trump has held 2 hours of talks with his Chinese counterpart in Beijing, with both leaders promising closer ties between the two countries.
And also coming up in the next hour, why has Prince Harry chosen now to write about anti-Semitism and Islamophobia in Britain? We'll be talking to a royal watch David Tennant as well on hitting new lows in the return to our screens of Gilly Cooper's Arrivals.
There's a confidence, I think, to Series 2, which gives it a swagger. I thought I was quite badly behaved in Series 1. I did terrible things in Series 2. I mean, really, really despicable.
The BBC News read by Jane Steele.
Allies of the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, say they expect him to launch a bid to oust Sir Keir Starmer in the coming hours, despite the Prime Minister hosting a series of meetings last night to try to shore up his authority. Sir Keir warned that a leadership contest would plunge Labour into chaos. This morning, the former Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, has revealed she's been cleared of wrongdoing over her tax affairs, paving the way for her to potentially mount her own challenge. Here's our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman.
On what could prove a day of multiple major political developments, here's the first. Angela Rayner, the former Deputy Prime Minister, has settled her tax affairs with HMRC. She told The Guardian and ITV that she had paid £40,000 in unpaid stamp duty, but has not had to pay a penalty. It removes the main obstacle to Ms. Rayner pursuing a leadership campaign should Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary, trigger a contest today. That is still what his allies and opponents widely expect him to do. If he presses ahead, he would need the backing of 80 fellow MPs, as would any other candidates who then jumped into the race. The exception is Sir Keir, who automatically has a place on the membership ballot. Another potential leadership rival is the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham. He's pulled out of his regular BBC Radio Manchester slot this morning. Finding and winning a parliamentary seat remains a major hurdle Mr. Burnham must clear before he can stand for the leadership. For now, though, there is no formal challenge, and Sir Keir has made clear that if there is one, he would stand in it.
Donald Trump has said the US and China will have a fantastic future together as he held high-stakes talks with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. The meeting in Beijing is believed to have focused on trade and the war in Iran. Mr. Xi said the US and China should be partners rather than rivals, but he issued a stark warning over the issue of Taiwan. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker reports from Beijing.
The two leaders talked for 2 hours, far longer than expected. President Xi warned Donald Trump that the issue of Taiwan, which Beijing claims is part of its territory, could bring the two countries into conflict. He is pushing for a delay or a reduction in US arms sales to the self-governing island. Donald Trump has brought the chief executives of 30 major tech businesses to Beijing in the hope that China will open its doors to more American firms. Mr. Trump also lavished praise on his host as he toured the 15th century Temple of Heaven, where emperors once prayed for a great harvest. He said Mr. Xi was a great leader and remarked to reporters that China was beautiful.
Ukraine's Air Force says the country was targeted by 675 Russian drones and more than 50 missiles overnight. The statement said most of them were intercepted, but some did get through. A number of residential buildings in Kyiv were hit, killing one person and injuring 16 others. As our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale reports from Ukraine, it follows a full day of heavy attacks.
This was a prolonged, sustained Russian attack on Ukraine, starting in the daytime with wave after wave of drones launched right across the country, nearly 900 over the past 24 hours. Overnight, there were multiple loud explosions in the capital, Kyiv, with several buildings hit. Rescue efforts are continuing this morning, with survivors at one residential building pulled from the rubble, but with reports of others still trapped. Just days ago, President Putin had agreed to a 3-day ceasefire, timed to allow Moscow to hold its Victory Day parade, marking the end of the Second World War. But this latest large-scale assault shows he's determined to continue his war.
Figures published in the past few minutes show that the UK economy grew by 0.6% between January and March. The Office for National Statistics said increases in the services, production and construction sectors contributed to the expansion. The head of the Airlines Trade Association has warned that higher ticket prices for passengers in Europe are inevitable because of the high cost of jet fuel. In an interview for the BBC, Willie Walsh from the International Air Transport Association said the impact of the Iran war would be felt by the aviation industry for months to come, even if the Strait of Hormuz were to reopen tomorrow. Here's our transport correspondent, Theo Leggett.
Jet fuel prices have soared since the conflict in the Gulf began. Europe, and the UK in particular, are usually highly dependent on imports from the region, which are currently unable to get through the Strait of Hormuz. People within the industry say this has yet to have a significant impact on airfares in Europe, partly because airlines have been offering discounts in order to entice reluctant travellers. But Willie Walsh said they would be unable to absorb the extra fuel costs for long, and prices would inevitably go up. He also suggested that unless alternative sources of fuel were found, there could be shortages over the summer months, although he was confident there would not be widespread cancellations of flights.
HM Revenue and Customs has awarded a 10-year contract to a British tech firm which will use artificial intelligence to help improve performance and detect fraud. The deal with Quantexa is worth £175 million. More details from our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
Quantexa says its systems will combine data collected by HMRC with external sources to help the tax office identify incidents of fraud and fix unintentional errors more quickly. It's hoped the tech will help spot hidden networks of companies and individuals masking fraudulent activity and track down legitimate payments made to HMRC but under the wrong reference number, as well as assist customer service staff with finding data about taxpayers across multiple systems. Quantexa says that decisions suggested by AI will still need to be checked by people. Last year, there were nearly 100,000 complaints made about HMRC, with slow response times being a major gripe.
A group of leading scientists has warned FIFA that its safety measures for heat during the Men's Football World Cup this summer are inadequate and could put players at risk of serious harm. The tournament, hosted by the United States, Canada and Mexico, begins next month. Experts have written to football's governing body saying plans for three-minute mandatory cooling breaks are not enough. The director of the think tank the New Weather Institute, Andrew Sims, is one of the signatories.
FIFA's guidelines are out of alignment with what is best practice in a lot of other areas by not requiring, for example, cooling breaks and having too few and too short cooling breaks. They're allowing players to exert themselves in a very strenuous activity at temperatures which are considered unsafe in a wide range of other areas.
The title race in the Scottish Premiership will go down to the wire after the top two, Hearts and Celtic, both won their matches last night. They'll now meet each other in the final game of the season on Saturday. The current leaders, Hearts, will be champions for the first time since 1960 if they can hold Celtic to a draw. Events are being held in Morecambe to celebrate what would have been the 100th birthday of one of the seaside town's most famous sons, the comedian Eric Morecambe. The BBC will mark the occasion by broadcasting a lost episode of Morecambe and Wise, which was recently found in a private collection, as Jane McCubbin reports.
Bring me fun, bring me the unmistakable sound of Morecambe and Wise, the renowned TV double act. Their TV specials were a Christmas Day appointment to view in millions of homes for more than a decade from the late 60s. Eric Morecambe died of a heart attack in 1984, aged just 58. And in the seaside resort, which gave Eric Bartholomew his stage name, they're hosting events to celebrate what would have been his 100th birthday. And this evening, a long-lost episode of Morecambe and Wise, last seen in 1968, will be broadcast in his honour.
Good evening. Hey, marvellous, huh? Who came on then?
The episode is found in the estate of a former TV industry professional, restored by a charity and then returned to the BBC. And you can see it on BBC Four, and it's available on the iPlayer this evening from 8.
Jane McCubbin reporting.
Thank you for that. 7:09 is the time. Angela Rayner is in the clear. No fine and no criticism from HMRC. She just has to pay the money she owed, and that is it. This is what we learnt from The Guardian an hour ago. Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary, meanwhile, saying nothing so far today. And all the expectation was, of course, that he was going to say something and indeed resign and stand against Keir Starmer. Last night, the Prime Minister himself saying to ministers and MPs that a challenge to his leadership could plunge us into chaos. Let us talk, perhaps for the first time in the programme, but not the last, to Chris Mason, our political editor, who is standing by. On Angela Rayner, first of all, Chris, and she's talked to The Guardian. She hasn't actually thrown her hat into the ring, as it were, but she hasn't exactly backed Keir Starmer either.
Quite. Morning to you, Justin. What we witnessed this morning is the start line jostle of the anticipated leadership contest in the Labour Party that is ahead. So Angela Rayner giving interviews to The Guardian and to ITV News, making it clear that she has been cleared of any deliberate wrongdoing or carelessness over her tax affairs, pointing, she says, to some ambiguity within the tax laws that she found herself on the hook for, and deciding not to challenge HMRC on that ambiguity and to pay the bill. And then, crucially, on the politics, suggesting that Keir Starmer should reflect on stepping aside rather than himself remaining in any leadership race once one begins, saying that she will play her part, but she's made it clear that she wasn't going to trigger the Prime Minister. In other words, effectively saying, over to you, Wes Streeting, if you've got the numbers, because if you have, there are others willing to get stuck in as well.
And the big question, does he?
Well, that is the big question. And certainly his rivals very late last night were suggesting that he was scrabbling around to get over that start line. Certainly the view from his supporters and his team is that his rivals would say that, wouldn't they? And stand by. His friends and supporters expect it to be imminent that he will declare. A couple of other developments to bring you up to date with this morning. So Andy Burnham, the Mayor of Greater Manchester. Of course, he's not an MP. He would need to be an MP in order to stand. He has dropped out of his weekly slot with Mike Sweeney on Radio Manchester. Why? His spokesman says he has to prioritise discussions arising from last week's local elections, which is an interesting form of words to describe where we stand this morning. Oh, and an additional development, Al Carnes, the Defence Minister, he shimmied up Everest recently, as it happens. He has a long piece in the New Statesman magazine setting out his diagnosis of why Labour is in so much trouble.
Yeah, which does open the door, doesn't it, to all manner of people, and possibly Ed Miliband as well is talked of, isn't it? All manner of people potentially getting into this. And yet, Keir Starmer himself, as I was saying last night to people, it had plunged into chaos, and from what we understand at the moment, fully intending to see off anyone.
Yes. So the people most willing to pick up the phone last night and talk about what they were doing in their campaigning amongst Labour MPs, were supporters of the Prime Minister. So he spent a good couple of hours in his House of Commons office after he'd been in the House of Commons itself yesterday afternoon, bringing in MPs and ministers, supportive cabinet ministers of the Prime Minister, touring the tea room and making the case for Keir Starmer, principally a case grounded in the argument that said a leadership race would be totally chaotic, would paralyse the government for months on end and would be irresponsible. That's been the Prime Minister's consistent view. But absolutely, yes, doubling down on the idea that he himself would be a candidate and he would be automatically a candidate if somebody else cleared the threshold to trigger a race. Now, does that remain his position once a race is live? Let's see. But they are giving absolutely every indication and repeated indication that, yes, he would stand.
OK. I suspect we will be talking to you again before the end of the programme. For the time being, though, Chris Mason, thanks.
It's 14 minutes past seven and President Trump is in China for his long-awaited summit with President Xi. In tow, he has the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, and a huge delegation of business execs from Elon Musk to Jensen Huang, the chief executive of chip giant NVIDIA. Now, before the talks began, Donald Trump described China's president as a leader of extraordinary distinction.
We're going to have a fantastic future together. Such respect for China, the job you've done. You're a great leader. I say it to everybody. You're a great leader. Sometimes people don't like me saying it, but I say it anyway because it's true. I only say the truth.
He does say it, and talks between the two leaders lasted for 2 hours. That's double the time expected. And since then, the two have had a photo opportunity outside the Temple of Heaven, an ancient temple site, and the rest of the delegation stayed some paces behind, closer to the park, as they stood in front of the striking blue and gold imperial building, part of a complex of temples where emperors would pray for good harvest. Well, earlier I spoke to Gladden Papin, co-founder and deputy editor of American Affairs and a friend of Vice President J.D. Vance, and I began by asking, what is at stake for the White House in this summit?
I think they have a long-term goal of trying to restore American industrial dominance and restore American manufacturing capacity, at the same time trying to achieve that greater reciprocity and fairness in trade that they've been calling for the last year. So I think we'll see out of that, at least there's expectations for agreements and larger purchases by the Chinese side of American exports. Hopefully some openness of the Chinese markets to American exports and in other sectors as well. This is really gets to be a strategic question about the importance of particular sectors, the significance of American advanced technology, and how much of that the Americans are willing to sell to the Chinese as well. Basically, what I'm saying is there are really big strategic questions in the American-Chinese relationship. I think at this point, both sides are looking for a reciprocal and fair exchange in those and some stability as well, particularly after the tariffs of the early Trump administration.
What we absolutely do know that China wants from the United States is something over Taiwan. We've heard from President Xi, if the Taiwan issue isn't handled well, the two countries, so China and the United States, will clash.
there is great concern in Taiwan and in the region that Donald Trump said that he knows that President Xi wants to talk about Taiwan and he's willing to do that. Of course, the United States just a few months ago agreed a record $11 billion deal when it comes to weapons for Taiwan, so Taiwan would be able to defend itself. There's another weapons package in the offing. How much is Donald Trump willing to cede on Taiwan in order to get China's help over Iran?
I'm a little bit skeptical that that it will play out in that manner. I think often these statements that Trump makes before negotiations are part of the setup of the negotiation itself. So these are things that he says in order to set up the negotiating situation. What I'm saying is they don't necessarily become the policy within the negotiation itself. The national security strategy from December, I think, is quite clear that the U.S. doesn't support any unilateral changes to the status quo in the Taiwan Strait. And of course, we will have to see what comes out of the negotiation. But I'm just saying to be mindful of these statements that occur before these quite complex negotiations, particularly in situations in which Trump makes the issues cross-cutting. I think really the fundamental issue from the American standpoint is that the strategic relationship between the United States and China has been a failure for the United States over the last 30 or 40 years. Because of that loss of manufacturing, we're entering into an era where the great powers in general, and the United States in particular, are becoming quite sensitive to what their strategic needs are. We can no longer assume that we're just living in the universal and globalized world where trade in all of the different sectors will even out and everything will be fine. We're entering into this stronger global competition. And I think in that environment, both sides have some things that they need.
And Donald Trump obviously likes President Xi and sort of on a personal level. He's very, very, very warm about him. But at the end of the day, despite the words, partners or rivals?
Yeah, there's a very great competition going on in the world, and the United States is maintaining its dominant position in the world economy. But there has been a bad strategic situation between the United States and China over the last 30 years. And what America is trying to do is to restore that manufacturing strength and make sure that it's not exposed to supply chain risk in particular, and to other kinds of threats against its dominance on the world stage, particularly in its own backyard. So I think that this is the framework in which the competition between the United States and China is occurring. Of course, it's important to have a stable relationship in key areas, even if there is a competition. So in that sense, those are not totally mutually exclusive things. But I think this administration is trying to look at Chinese activity in the world with a clear eye and see what the United States can do in order to preserve its dominance in critical areas and to maintain and extend its manufacturing and industrial capacity.
Gladden Papin, thank you so much for your time. It's 20 minutes past seven. Now, as we heard in the news, the UK economy grew by 0.6% in the first 3 months of this year. That is more than expected. Over now to Sean Farrington. Sean, you can tell us, is it too early to cheer?
Well, what we know, we've been waiting for some more numbers, haven't we, Katia, about how the economy has been getting on, not just before the war in Iran began at the end of February, but then what the knock-on effects were. And these are the first estimates from the Office of National Statistics that include the month of March. But of course, many trade consequences of a higher oil price, blocked shipping routes, can take a while to filter down. But all sectors of the economy grew in that first 3 months of the year, led by the stronger services sector growth as well. Production and construction growing at the same time. Got Mark Allen with me, who's the chief executive of Landsec. So they're one of the UK's biggest real estate companies. The property developer, it's got retail sites like Liverpool One, Bluewater in Kent, office residential locations as well. Has a good overview of the British economy. Mark, good morning. Your reaction to these numbers, better than expected growth in the first quarter?
Yes, I think a little bit better than expected. But I think what we've seen for quite some time in the economy has been that, certainly in our real estate world, that prime locations, whether that's the shopping centres you've mentioned, like Liverpool or Bluewater, well-located offices, demand has been more and more concentrating there. So the growth we've seen across our portfolio has been outstripping the economy, economic growth for quite some time. And we've seen our best stats for 20 years in the numbers we released this morning.
Yeah, and so when the Chancellor says this morning in response to these economic numbers, today's figures show the government has the right economic plan. Your company sounds like in the areas where you are is going the way you want it to. Does the government have the right economic plan?
I think with all these things, there are some things that are moving in the right direction, some things that maybe not quite so much. But if I was to look at the positives, I think the moves towards planning reform intended to increase house building and development more generally, moves towards deregulation, moves around trying to decouple electricity pricing from gas. I think those are all things that for the long term have got to be positive. But as I've said to you before, these are measures that take years. Not weeks or months to come through. So those policies, I think, are very supportive. Some of the shorter term policies that we saw a year or so ago around minimum wage, around national insurance, business rates, those are things that get in the way near term. But those longer term policy shifts, I think those are the right ones to be going. And I very much hope the government sees those through.
And in the shorter term, do you expect the impact of the war in Iran, which can take time to feed through to different parts of the economy? Do you expect things to get tougher?
At the moment, the key thing for us to stress is that we've seen no slowing down of demand at all since that Middle East conflict started. Clearly, the longer that goes on and the more that gets baked into inflation globally, the more there must be risk around what that does for the economy. And we know the UK has an economy which is a little bit more exposed to inflation, particularly with energy.
Thank you, Mark. Chief Executive of Lantech, Mark Allen there.
Sean, thank you. 23 minutes past seven. It was the Gilly Cooper bunk buster that ended up at the BAFTAs. Now it is back with Naked Tennis, Tales of Excess from the 1980s TV industry, turning Danny Dyer into a sex symbol. Rivals was one of the real small screen sensations of the last couple of years. Series 2 lands on Disney Plus on Friday. Our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson got exclusive behind-the-scenes access during filming and has been talking to the cast.
Okay, here we go. This will be with fireworks.
Stand by!
A bitterly cold November evening in the Cotswolds, where the 1980s have been recreated. A night shoot is about to begin for the all-star cast of Rivals Season 2.
My name's Danny Dyer and I play Freddie Jones.
So you're about to do a bonfire scene. It's cold out there. You've been in this game a while. What are the tricks to survive in a night?
Well,
you've
got to put them heat pads in your trotters. Double one for me toes. Long johns, obviously.
You were held up as a sex symbol.
Yeah, weird, isn't it? With a moustache and a wig. He's really rich, but he's still very much his essence is working class, and he's kind, and he tries to do the right thing, and I think maybe that's what women found attractive. It can't be me belly and me breasts.
I can't stop thinking about you. It's like a beautiful dream I had.
How long could this show go?
I mean, you can stretch it out for as long as you want, really. Obviously, we're coming to the end of the 80s now, so we're sort of encroaching on the early 90s if we go again. So, you know, I know there's a moustache is a thing at the moment, but hopefully this can come off.
But you might lose the sex.
My grandchildren only know me as a moustached man, and that depresses me slightly.
Wait a minute, is this real?
Yeah, of course it is.
OK, let's start lighting up the sparklers.
The location, just outside Tetbury, is the Elizabethan Manor Chavenage House, which in Rivals is the home of TV presenter Declan O'Hara, played by Aidan Turner.
And this is a building you know very well.
I do know very well, yeah. This is Poldark's house. Every time you do something, you kind of meet a different fan base. And this is much younger people, which I was quite surprised at. I thought with Gilly Cooper and her books, and when they were published, I thought maybe you would get an older audience.
Tonight at 6, the best-selling author Gilly Cooper has died at the age of 88.
What was the day like with the news of her death?
Yeah, it was really shocking. Through. Really shocking.
Were you actually on set?
Yeah, we were on set. I mean, it was only, I think, 5 weeks prior we were in Gilly's house. you know, she'd be missed greatly. She was such a spirited figure on set, funny and filthy and brilliant.
Please make sure the front of the house is clear.
Victoria Smurfit is his on-screen wife, Maud.
Jilly wouldn't have wanted us to sit down and have a mope. She would have wanted us to continue working and have a glass of champagne afterwards, and that's exactly what we did.
So how different is the second series to the first?
It's just more. It's just bigger, bolder, bonkier.
Fasten your seatbelt. It's going to be quite a ride.
Alex Hassel plays the Lothario Rupert Campbell Black, described as the handsomest man in England.
His behaviour would absolutely, quite rightly, be admonished and challenged, much more so if it were in a contemporary setting. Really early on in their relationship, Rupert gropes Taggy, and there's very little comeback from that.
In real life, he was intrigued to see what younger audiences would make of the series.
Well, I'm not on TikTok or anything like that, but my nieces and nephews are, and they, when I see them, are showing me these TikToks of Taggy and Rupert, that they're kind of yearning for each other, I understand, has taken off, which is fascinating. I think what they really respond to is the idea that this young woman can be a form of redemption for him.
Shall we replenish? Replenish sparklers!
And waiting patiently to film his part, David Tennant, who plays the moral vacuum at the centre of the piece, Lord Tony Baddingham.
The scene I'm filming tonight is I'm doing something slightly nefarious in some bushes outside. Which could mean anything in this show, frankly.
What is the biggest difference between Series 1 and Series 2?
There's a confidence, I think, to Series 2, which gives it a swagger. I thought I was quite badly behaved in Series 1. I do terrible things in Series 2. I mean, really, really despicable.
And action!
And that was Colin Patterson reporting there. It's 28 minutes past seven and time for the sports news with Jane Dougal.
Morning, Katia. We'll come to an exciting night of football in just a moment. But first, Rory McIlroy says he's no longer in pain after losing a toenail ahead of the second major of the year. The Masters champion will tee off at the US PGA Championship later today. Our golf correspondent Ian Carter is at Aronimink near Philadelphia. He told me earlier McIlroy is in good spirits despite the bizarre story.
Yes, it was a blister underneath his toenail on his right foot, the little toe, that caused him a fair amount of discomfort last week when he was playing at Quail Hollow. And he took it into his own hands at the start of this week, softened up the nail in the shower, and then, in his own words, ripped it off and burst the blister underneath. And he thought that that was the end of the problem. But then on the Tuesday afternoon, he went for 9 holes of practice, had to abort that after 3 holes and got a buggy ride back off the golf course. Such was the discomfort. So he's admitted that he's going to have to manage this, manage to get onto the range on the eve of the championship. But he looks like he's going to have to play this USPGA with a fair amount of discomfort from his right foot.
I think we're all wincing as we were listening to that description there, Ian. But if successful, McIlroy would become the first player to win both the Masters and the USPGA in the same year since 1975. So it would be rare.
Yes, it would be very rare, and I suspect even rarer given the way that the calendar is now. Back in 1975, when Jack Nicklaus managed to do that, that was when the USPGA was played in August as the final major of the year. This time it is obviously in May, and it would be the second leg of a calendar year Grand Slam were he to do it. I did ask McIlroy at the start of this week about the prospect of, as he is the only man who could do the calendar year Grand Slam, he just said, look, it's incredibly difficult. It's not something that you could think about it. Certainly at this stage, you just have to put yourself in contention and see how the chips fall on the Sunday at each of these majors.
Well, he did say that about getting back-to-back Masters, and look how that turned out. The defending champion is Scottie Scheffler. He is, of course, one of the favourites. What are his chances like, Ian? And also, who else is in form?
It's funny because Scheffler is the short odds favourite, and I think justifiably so. But the fact that he hasn't won for a while means he's flying a little under the radar. But you drill down on those results, he's been runner-up in each of his last 3 tournaments. That means he is playing some very, very good golf. The other players to watch really on form this year are Cameron Young, who won the Players' Championship and has won again on the PGA Tour, and Britain's Matt Fitzpatrick, who who was runner-up to Young at the Players' Championship, won the Heritage event the week after the Masters, and won the Pairs event with his brother Alex. He's in great form, and the stock behind that great form has been his approach play, and that is going to be the commodity that we think is going to be the most valuable one on very demanding target areas on what are huge greens here at Eronimink.
All right, Ian Carter, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jane.
Now to a thrilling and controversial night in Scotland. Premiership leaders Hearts beat Falkirk 3-0, but a questionable VAR decision saw Celtic awarded a 99th minute penalty, meaning they beat Motherwell 3-2. The title race will now go down to the last day of the season when Celtic host Hearts, who are ahead by just 1 point. And Manchester City beat Crystal Palace to ensure the Premier League title race continues into the final week of the campaign. City won 3-0, leaving them 2 points behind leaders Arsenal with two games to go.
Thank you, Jane.
Lift your midweek with new 6:30 comedies.
Thank you.
On Tuesday nights, join Frank Skinner for One Person Found This Helpful.
The review is entitled Great for Breaking Necks.
Wow. It's got to be a cheese.
I can't think of a cheese that's ever broken my neck. Unless I've driven past the shop and gone, ooh, brie!
And on Wednesdays, Ian Smith is stressed.
We're so reliant on technology that if the internet goes down for 5 minutes, everyone loses their minds. That's why I have started printing out the internet. I keep trying to refresh the BBC News homepage and getting paper cuts.
New 6:30 comedies for Tuesday and Wednesday nights.
Very good.
To listen on your smart speaker, just say play Radio 4.
You are listening now to Today on Radio 4 with Kat Chandler, Justin Webb. The time's 28 minutes to 8. Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
Allies of the Health Secretary Wes Streeting say they expect him to challenge the Prime Minister for the Labour leadership in the coming hours. It's unclear if he has the support of 81 MPs required. Last night, Sir Keir Starmer warned MPs and ministers that a leadership contest would plunge the government into chaos. The former Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, has settled her tax affairs with HMRC. She resigned last September after it emerged she'd underpaid stamp duty on a flat in Hove. It means she could now potentially enter a race for the next Labour leader. Official figures released in the past half hour show that the UK economy grew by 0.6% in the first 3 months of the year. In March, the output grew by 0.3%, contrary to analyst predictions that it would shrink after the start of the Iran war that month. Presidents Xi Jinping and Donald Trump have held 2 hours of talks in Beijing, longer than had been planned. The Chinese leader warned Mr. Trump that the issue of Taiwan, which Beijing claims as part of its territory, could bring the two countries into conflict. He's pushing for a delay or a reduction in US arms sales to the self-governed island. Officials in Kyiv say one person has been killed and 16 others were injured in heavy Russian drone and missile attacks on the city overnight. Rescue teams are trying to pull survivors from the rubble of residential buildings that were hit. The Ukrainian military says the country was targeted by 675 Russian drones and more than 50 missiles overnight. Events are being held in Morecambe today to mark what would have been the 100th birthday of the comedian Eric Morecambe, who grew up in the seaside town. This evening, the BBC will broadcast a lost episode of Morecambe and Wise, which was recently found in a private collection.
Thank you for that. 25 to 8 is the time. Nobody was more shocked by the local election disaster for Labour, more desirous of action to change the picture than the Mayor of West Yorkshire, Tracy Brabin. She told Radio Leeds that the results locally were catastrophic. Reform took control of Wakefield Council for the first time. They won 58 out of the 63 council seats. Labour had been in continuous control of Wakefield since 1974. The party now left with just one seat there following Thursday's election. Tracy Brabin did not call on the Prime Minister to resign. She did make it plain, though, in her view, change needed to come. And indeed, she popped into Downing Street yesterday to see Keir Starmer face to face. And we will talk to Tracy Brabin. She is here in the studio in just a second. But things are moving fast. And Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, has just been talking to our political correspondent, Henry Zeffman, in Downing Street. She had this message about a potential leadership contest if it should come. She was talking to Henry after the latest figures show the UK economy grew by 0.6% in the first 3 months of the year. Let's listen to what she has just said.
Labour MPs have got an important decision to make today, but the numbers show that the economy is growing and that when we entered this conflict, our economy was growing strongly. Because of the decisions that I have made as Chancellor, we shouldn't put that at risk. Thank you very much, Henry.
Just quickly, are you pleased that your former...
There we are, an in-depth interview to Henry. But at least she did talk to him, and that is the position very much of the government and of Downing Street this morning, that Keir Starmer remains in place and is intending to do so, and anyone trying to destabilise him is acting in the not in the good interests of the Labour Party, but also not in the good interests of the country. So, Tracy Braben, listening to that here in the studio, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You saw Keir Starmer yesterday, didn't you? Do you want him to stay? Did you tell him that?
I did see him yesterday, and it's good news about the economy. However, you were right that the results in West Yorkshire were catastrophic for the Labour Party. We had five Labour local authorities, and now two are going to be reform, three no overall control, and only Leeds has got a Labour majority. And what's really frustrating is that the public have waited for so long, you know, 14 years of austerity and then the Brexit years and then COVID. And finally, they've got a Labour government and we just are not moving fast enough. And that's what I said to the Prime Minister, that we have to escalate the pace of change.
Did he convince you that he was the man to do it?
Well, look, we had 15 minutes before the King's speech. We had a frank conversation. I explained the things that I would expect to see from him. But when he himself, in front of, I think it was a select committee, when he said, you know, I pull levers and nothing happens. The system has got to change. The government is holding back change that people are crying out for, because Labour is the party for the working people. It is not reform run by a millionaire, but funded by a billionaire.
This really matters, though. Not just a sort of runners and riders thing, but you are such an important voice in Labour. You're such an important constituency. You represent such an important part of, well, certainly Labour's past, if not again its future in West Yorkshire. Just to be clear to people this morning, do you or do you not want Keir Starmer to remain as Prime Minister?
Well, I would expect to see change if he were to remain as Prime Minister. But currently, right, so currently there is no leadership election, and you're asking me directly, but I have no horse in this race. It is
including the Prime Minister.
Well, I would expect to see the change that I've asked of him, because we can't continue as we are. And a perfect example is in 2021, I promised the public bringing buses back into public control, and we will only be fully franchised by 2028. That is far too long. We are a region without a tram. Leeds, the only city of its size in Europe without a tram, and yet we have to prove it cannot be a bus. Where is the logic in that? We have been given the money, but we want to be able to move fast and deliver. And if you want growth, as Rachel does, you have got to give mayors greater autonomy, greater levers. And you've got James Murray coming on later. He absolutely understands that. And the May's lecture was great for mayors because of the approach to fiscal.
And what he's going to tell us, I mean, I can tell you this before he even sits in the chair, what he's going to say is, for goodness sake, don't destabilise us. Allow us to finish the job. Allow us to bring all the change that you've just talked about. And we get it. We're going to do it faster. So if he says those things, do you accept that the Prime Minister should be given the chance?
Well, look, we have to have deeds, not words. And everybody...
Do you accept they should be given the chance?
Well, of course, they have had 2 years, and now we need to make sure that the next 2 years are different, because we cannot continue as we have been, because we will not have the chance again, and we will have wasted the opportunity of a lifetime to have a Labour government.
So at the very least, what you want to hear from him and from Keir Starmer, by extension, is how things are going to be different.
It's what
not
is going
good
to be
enough
different
if they come into these studios and say, look, we're going to accelerate the pace of change without telling you how.
Exactly that. We can't have more reviews, more pilots, where nothing happens at the end of it. Another example is water. The public feel completely disconnected to the big bonuses water bosses are getting, and yet their bills are going up. I and my two other Yorkshire Labour mayors hold Yorkshire Water to account, but we can't land a blow, because we don't have any power over the companies, not
would you
to
like
continue
to see
as
them
they are.
Renationalised as one
I know the public would, and I would see. My frustration with Yorkshire Water is that I don't see any improvement, even though we are really holding them right. to account.
Because that would be bold. I mean, it would be a bold move, and it's something that's quite a few Labour MPs would like to see happen. The government has resisted it. You're saying stop resisting it.
Absolutely. And what is making life better for the people that we're here to serve? So, for example, the Mayor's Fare, the £2 bus fare we brought in West Yorkshire, the first in the country to do it. When I was door knocking, that's what landed with the public. We've saved the people of West Yorkshire £80 million on the Mayor's Fare. You do bold action and you rewire government because, frankly, it's like scouring the world for an actor to be in your play, and you get the best, the most famous actor, and then if the play is crap, people will leave in the interval.
And you know all about not crap.
we have got to rewire government.
As a former actor yourself, yeah. Just a final thought about Angela Rayner, because you're close to her, aren't you? And she's cleared to be back, basically, isn't she? By what the HMRC seem to have told her, that she's not going to face a fine or any kind of consequences at all. She merely pays back the money that she owes, and that's it. So politically, do you want her to be now part of the conversation?
Well, I'm delighted that this has been resolved, because I know how painful it's been for her, because it's also incredibly personal, because it's about her son as well. Mm. And yes, we're friends. I know what she said this morning is that she wants to play her part, but we are in agreement that we can't continue with the process of government as it is, because it's not fit for the 21st century. It will not deliver the pace of change that the public have been waiting for over 15 years and are crying out for change. We cannot be the party left behind.
Tracy Brabin, thank you very much for talking to us. And as you have already told people, James Murray, the Chief Secretary
yes,
of the Treasury,
indeed.
Will be joining us at 10 past 8. Thank you.
Pleasure.
It's coming up to 17 minutes to 8.
Prince Harry has written for the New Statesman and written in serious terms about this country and about anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim hatred. Images from Gaza, Lebanon and the wider region, he says, of devastated communities and entire neighbourhoods levelled and reduced to rubble have shaken people to their core. But, he continues, nothing, whether criticism of a government or the reality of violence and destruction, can ever justify hostility towards an entire people or faith. Let us talk to Roy Nicker, who is the royal editor of the Sunday Times and is on the line. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Well, why? What do you understand? Does anyone know what it is that impelled him to write this and to write it for the New Statesman? And indeed, did he write it himself?
Well, I have to say, doesn't it? The first thing that came to my mind when I read this piece last night was how much it actually follows in the vein of former royal interventions on this issue. The king, of course, has been very strong in his support of the Jewish community, and you will see that again from him today. We had a very strongly worded intervention from Prince William a couple of years ago on the Gaza-Israel conflict. So there is nothing new about this. I think in terms of why now, I know that Harry, on his recent visit to Australia with Meghan, when he met with survivors of the Bondi Beach terror attack, the Jewish community there, that had a big impact on him. He, of course, went to Jordan quite recently too and went to a refugee camp and met girls and children there. And again, that affected him. So I think he felt he wanted to speak out on that. The reason why do it? Harry, obviously, you know, still a divisive figure, quite controversial. But I think the fact that he's writing this piece shows that he still wants to try and have a voice on some level. And the fact that you and I are talking about it this morning means people are still kind of interested to hear what he has to say.
Yeah, and he's doing it off his own bat, presumably. This isn't okayed with the palace or indeed with the government. I mean, it's just something he does.
It's definitely not okayed with the palace or the government. I mean, I'm here in Reggio Emilia, Northern Italy, with the Princess of Wales, and suffice to say, when Harry makes these kind of interventions, when other members of the royal family manoeuvres, it always raises eyebrows. But, you know, he doesn't really care about that now. He's out of the official fold. Then again, you know, Prince William's intervention a couple of years ago was run by government. It wasn't authorised by government. So members of the royal family, and Harry is still a member of the royal family, not a working one, tread that fine line. What I would say, I think, certainly, you know, the king on this subject, the king's recently become patron of the Community Security Trust too. I think members of the royal family feel sometimes actions might be less controversial than words on these slightly hot topics.
He also refers, doesn't he, further down the piece, to his own mistakes in the past. This business where he once dressed in a Nazi uniform, and he addresses it head on.
He does. I mean, he wore this Nazi uniform to a fancy dress party in 2005, something that was deeply offensive and controversial, and he had to apologise for. He talks about the fact that he's acutely aware of his own past mistakes, thoughtless actions. I think some members of the royal family may raise an eyebrow at that too. It's interesting he's put that in there. He raised it in his book, Spare. The fact that it still plays on his mind and he feels he needs to apologise for it is interesting. But I think, you know, Harry talks in this piece about geography not having a bearing on speaking out. And I think, you know, he still feels he wants to have a voice. Whether or not anyone's listening remains to be seen, but people are still interested in what he has to say.
That's a really interesting point. I mean, a voice and a presence, as it were, in this land.
He definitely wants to have a presence in this land. We've heard that from him every time. You know, the interview he gave to the BBC last year, talking about wanting to come back more and spend more time with his family. We are going to see him back here soon. He'll be here in the summer doing stuff for the Invictus Games. Harry may live in Montecito. He may have an alternative royal court in California with Meghan, but he still feels, as we heard from him in Ukraine recently, he is still a member of the royal family. He's not going to shut up.
Yeah, and there's nothing the royal family can do about that.
There's nothing they can do about it. I think there's a sort of heavy sigh sometimes when Harry makes these kind of interventions. But then again, like I said, we are going to see something very strong from the king today supporting the Jewish community. So this is not new. This is in the vein of what his father still does and what his brother has done. So I think that's interesting in itself, actually, because Harry's quite good at sort of trying to, I think, remove himself and sometimes set himself up against the royal family. This is sort of in a vein of supporting the Jewish community, speaking out about the conflict. But the fact that it comes from him, it's always going to create headlines, Justin.
Brian Eka, Royal Editor of the Sunday Times. Thank you.
It's coming up to 12 minutes to 8. In just a moment, we'll turn our attention to today's GDP figures and whether there's any hope the economy will avoid damage from the Iran war. But first, it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is the Reverend Lucy Winkett, Rector of St James Piccadilly.
Good morning. An occasion such as the state opening of Parliament and the delivery of the King's speech yesterday in Westminster is a moment when the state, in all its constituent parts, becomes visible. The dress may seem arcane, the traditions quaint, but in the ceremonies, the UK population witnessed a repetition of the checks and balances that operate largely unwritten within the British Constitution between the monarch and the debating chambers of the Lords and the Commons. At the end of his speech, the monarch offered a prayer that God would bless the councils of politicians. It was a public expression of the social contract in the UK, one that reflects the individual's position as both citizen and subject. And in doing so, it reaffirmed the democratic principle that the will of the people is made visible and that it endures beyond any single monarch, politician, civil servant, or government of the day. One of the striking features of the ceremony is the silence that accompanies the speech itself. It feels like the calm before the storm, because back in the Commons, as is proper, the sharp and often combative debates of politics and economics quickly resume. Today is Ascension Day. In Christian liturgy, the day when the contingent politics of the life of Christ are transformed into mystical meditation on the God we can no longer see. The movement from flesh to spirit, from the hot fury of Jesus' execution to the unseen presence of the Spirit who comes to empower human beings to change the world themselves, even after Christ has gone. This is the day that Christianity discovers its mystical side. Its teaching is that it's possible for human beings to be able to connect with God in the core of ourselves. Often helped by keeping silence, by resting our soul, immersed in the communion with God that doesn't depend on words or priests or intermediaries of any kind. Ascension teaches us to be ourselves before God, just as we are, so God can help us become who we can be. It's emphatically not the same as self-help or self-actualization. It's not so much you do you, but you do God, in your own way and in your own time. The mysticism of ascension is a counterbalance to the tumultuous events of Jesus' life and offers a template for dealing with turbulence in our own lives. The teaching of today is that each of us has an inner spiritual life ungovernable by the church or any other public institution. and that in all the chaos of life in the world, the invitation is to remain resilient, truthful, and committed in the depth of our soul to peace.
And that was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Lucy Winkett. You can hear the Ascension Day service, by the way, live from St Martin in the Fields Church at 8 o'clock this evening here on Radio 4. The time now, 9 minutes to 8.
In the last hour, we've had GDP figures for March as well as growth figures for the first 3 months of this year. And that suggests 0.6% of growth between January and March. Now, those figures are from the Office of National Statistics, the ONS. But the data, of course, covers a period just before the outbreak of the Iran war. Well, it started right at the end of February, and that is having a huge impact on the global economy. So although signs of resilience might seem promising, can these signs last in the long term? Jonathan Haskell is Professor of Economics at Imperial College Business School. He's also a member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee, and he joins me now. Good morning to you.
Morning, Katia.
Now, of course, we're all desperate for good news. But how reliable are these figures, do you think? First of all, as I said, I mean, the Iran war started only at the end of February. And there's also been a suggestion shared by some in the Bank of England, reported also by Bloomberg this week, that the ONS isn't calculating GDP correctly.
Thanks, Katia. Look, the ONS figures are always subject to revision. As you and your listeners will know, the ONS surveys around 70,000 firms every month, so they do a very big job on all of that. But the revision is normally, on average, around 0.3%. So a figure of 0.6%, around half of that, is potentially sort of revisable. I don't think there's any particular worry that these figures are any less reliable than they previously were. So I would discount that. The issue, of course, is, as you rightly said, the conflict in the Middle East broke out right at the end of the quarter. So they're pretty backward looking in terms of thinking about what our future prospects are going to be.
Yes, yeah, so we've already heard from Deutsche Bank's chief UK economist, Sanjay Raja. He said, OK, this figure smashed expectations, but he warns it can't last. How concerned are you about the broader impact on the economy of the blockade on the Strait of Hormuz? I mean, we don't know when it might end.
No, indeed. And crucial to the deliberations of the Bank of England and the various other economic forecasters is exactly, as you say, how long the economic dislocation is going to last. If it lasts for a long time and it gets baked in to people's inflation expectations and a general kind of inflationary pressure in the economy, that's obviously going to be bad news for the economy, and interest rates would then have to be higher than people were previously expecting. So the duration of this conflict is very important from an economic point of view.
Absolutely. I mean, the government obviously is going to be affected. Our economy is going to be affected by things out of our control, you know, geopolitics. There's certain things that we can do indeed at home. The Chancellor has just spoken to our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman, saying the very strong numbers published today, she says, shows this plan is the right one to get the economy growing. Sorry. Of course, we had the King's speech yesterday outlining the direction of travel for the government. What did you feel? Did the speech hit the right notes, right areas in terms of potential for boosting the economy, or were there missed opportunities, do you think?
Well, boosting the economy is, of course, a big agenda item. I think one thing which is interesting about these figures is the contrasting fortunes of some of the subsectors of the economy. The information and communications sector, which of course includes AI and all of the technology around that, is up relative to pre-pandemic around 40%. Unfortunately, the health sector is pretty much only just back to its pre-pandemic levels. So one thing one I think can get out of these figures is a sense of the very different fortunes of the different sectors of the economy. And I'm sure those will be areas where government policy will be laser focused on trying to help those sectors, especially those sectors which are lagging behind.
And if I can just sort of
take a step back again and have a look at the conflict in Iran, you know, the blockade on the Strait of Hormuz. Mm. The IMF predicted that the energy shock from the Iran war will hit the UK more than any other advanced economy. Now, can you explain why that is? Because you can look at Germany, for example. It also relies heavily, like the UK, on energy imports. So why are we particularly affected?
The reason is that our energy sector is particularly dominated by gas. When the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine, which occasionally happens in the UK, surprise, surprise, then we need to bring in energy supply for our homes and our businesses.
But so does Germany.
It's particularly in Britain that we rely on gas as the marginal source of supply. That is to say, as the source of supply which tops everything up when other things are not working. And in other countries, they've got much more base load from nuclear and other types of electricity stations. So we're particularly vulnerable to gas prices here. And I think that's why the sensitivity of inflation to these energy prices is higher in the UK than it is in other countries.
We've almost run out of time, but I would just like to ask you, so there was seemingly some positivity this morning. Should we be a little optimistic?
We should be very optimistic, I think, about the prospects from AI. AI is going to help large areas of technology, and in particular, it's going to help innovation in the very process of innovation, better drugs, better medical supplies, better ways of living our lives. So that's a big source of optimism, I think.
Good to hear. Jonathan Haskell, Professor of Economics at Imperial College Business School, thank you.
The 8th of August, 1963. A gang of thieves hold up a British Royal Mail train on its way from Glasgow to London. More than £2 million was stolen, and Ronnie Biggs was the most famous face of the great train robbery.
Daniel Mays reveals the true story of Ronnie Biggs.
A train robbery, a prison escape, and 36 years on the run.
Gangster presents the story of Ronnie Biggs.
Listen first on BBC Sounds.
Weather time comes this morning from Chris Fawkes. Morning, Chris.
Hi, Justin. Good morning. And today, another day of sunshine and showers. The showers will become heavy, widespread, thundery, with some hailstorms around this afternoon. Reason being, you only need 8 degrees Celsius temperatures to make those big storms, and all of the UK will see temperatures above that, so that's why the showers are going to be particularly widespread. We've already got lots of showers across northern Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, southwest England, eastern coastal counties of England. The dry spots, well, southern Scotland, not many showers at the moment. Large parts of northern England away from the North Sea coast looking mostly fine with sunshine, and there aren't many showers at the moment in the Midlands. Of course, all that will change as those temperatures rise, the showers become much more widespread, and come the afternoon, a high chance of catching a downpour, some of them heavy with hail and thunder, some of the biggest downpours across parts of North East Scotland and across parts of Eastern England, especially East Anglia and the South East. With these downpours, some tricky travelling conditions, some intense bouts of rain, temperatures dropping by about 5 degrees Celsius as those big storms come through, and our temperatures generally running well below average. Today's highs 10 to 15 Celsius. There will be gusty winds around these showers and across western areas of the UK, with gusts of wind around 30 to 40 miles an hour. Now, looking at the weather picture tomorrow, it is another day of sunshine and showers. However, the showers will not be anywhere near as widespread, so you've got a much better chance of it staying dry with some sunny spells. You can count yourself quite unlucky if you see one of these downpours tomorrow. So overall, a better kind of day, gradually things warming up into next week.
Thank you, Chris. You're listening to Today with Justin Webb and Katya Adler here on Radio 4.
It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 14th of May. The headlines this morning: the former Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner says she's settled her tax affairs with HMRC, removing a major obstacle to her pursuing a potential leadership campaign against Keir Starmer. Allies of the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, expect him to trigger a contest within hours. We'll be hearing from the Chief Secretary to the Treasury after the news bulletin. And two other headlines: President Trump has promised closer ties with China after 2 hours of talks with President Xi in Beijing, there is a warning of potential conflict over Taiwan. And Russia continued its wave of airstrikes on Ukraine overnight, heavy attacks on the capital, Kiev.
Coming up in the next hour, Sir Keir Starmer has made his pitch to bring the UK closer to the EU. But what will the EU want in return? We speak to a leading negotiator. And the AI artwork inviting everyone, including Justin and myself, to have their face on display in the National Portrait Gallery. The news is read by Jane Steele.
Sir Keir Starmer is bracing for a potential leadership challenge from his health secretary today, while his former deputy prime minister has cleared a major obstacle to joining any race herself. A row about Angela Rayner's tax affairs has been settled as a barrier to her standing in a leadership contest, but she now says the matter is settled. She made the announcement on the same day Wes Streeting is expected to resign from the government and launch a bid to oust the prime minister. Last night, Sir Keir held a series of talks with Labour MPs, warning that a leadership contest would plunge the party into chaos. Here's our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman.
On what could prove a day of multiple major political developments, here's the first. Angela Rayner, the former Deputy Prime Minister, has settled her tax affairs with HMRC. She told The Guardian and ITV that she had paid £40,000 in unpaid stamp duty, but has not had to pay a penalty. It removes the main obstacle to Ms Rayner pursuing a leadership campaign should Wes Streeting, the health secretary, trigger a contest today. That is still what his allies and opponents widely expect him to do. If he presses ahead, he would need the backing of 80 fellow MPs, as would any other candidates who then jumped into the race. The exception is Sir Keir, who automatically has a place on the membership ballot. Another potential leadership rival is the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham. He's pulled out of his regular BBC Radio Manchester slot this morning. Finding and winning a parliamentary seat remains a major hurdle Mr Burnham must clear before he can stand for the leadership. For now, though, there is no formal challenge, and Sir Keir has made clear that if there is one, he would stand in it.
In her interview with ITV News, Angela Rayner refused to say if Sir Keir Starmer should stay in office and was asked directly whether she would mount a leadership challenge.
I've said we have to do better and we all have to play our part in that, and I will play my part in delivering on that. But people put their trust in us. They put their trust in us to deliver for them after 14 years of the Conservative psychodrama and, you know, failure to meet the challenge. We have got to meet the challenge now as a team, as Labour, as a government that promised the British people that it would be better, and we have now got to start delivering that.
Figures published in the past hour show that the UK economy grew by 0.6% in the first 3 months of the year. It was a stronger performance than some analysts had expected, but the numbers largely reflect the period ahead of the war in Iran. More details from our Deputy Economics Editor, Darshini David.
After a lacklustre end to 2025, households and businesses started 2026 on a brighter note, resulting in the strongest growth of any of the major economies in the first quarter. And the expansion continued in March, even as energy costs rose. While that sign of resilience is encouraging, analysts expect the economy to have stagnated since and growth to remain weak over the summer as confidence has been knocked and as higher fuel and other costs eat into profits and incomes. The Chancellor Rachel Reeves says the government has the right plan, while the Shadow Chancellor Sir Mel Stride says the unrest in the Labour Party is destabilising the economy.
Donald Trump has said the US and China will have a fantastic future together as he held high-stakes talks with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. The meeting in Beijing is believed to have focused on trade and the war in Iran. Mr Xi said the US and China should be partners rather than rivals, but he issued a stark warning over the issue of Taiwan. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker reports from Beijing.
The two leaders talked for 2 hours, far longer than expected. President Xi warned Donald Trump that the issue of Taiwan, which Beijing claims is part of its territory, could bring the two countries into conflict. He is pushing for a delay or a reduction in US arms sales to the self-governing island. Donald Trump has brought the chief executives of 30 major tech businesses to Beijing in the hope that China will open its doors to more American firms. Mr. Trump also lavished praise on his host as he toured the 15th century Temple of Heaven, where emperors once prayed for a great harvest. He said Mr. Xi was a great leader and remarked to reporters that China was beautiful.
Ukraine's Air Force says the country was targeted by 675 Russian drones and more than 50 missiles overnight. The statement said most of them were intercepted, but some did get through. A number of residential buildings in Kyiv were hit, killing one person and injuring 16 others. As our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale reports from Ukraine, it follows heavy attacks yesterday.
This was a prolonged, sustained Russian attack on Ukraine through day and night, with wave after wave of drones launched right across the country, more than 1,500 over the past 24 hours. Overnight, there were multiple loud explosions in the capital, Kyiv, with several buildings hit. Rescue efforts are continuing this morning, with survivors at one residential building pulled from the rubble, but with reports of others still trapped. Just days ago, President Putin had agreed to a three-day ceasefire, timed to allow Moscow to hold its Victory Day parade, marking the end of the Second World War. But this latest large-scale assault shows he's determined to continue his war.
Air passengers in Europe have been warned that flights will inevitably become more expensive because of the impact of the Iran war on the price of jet fuel. The head of the International Air Transport Association, Willie Walsh, said companies have been offering discounts in order to entice reluctant travellers, but that can't last forever.
There's just no way that the airlines can absorb the additional costs that they're experiencing. There may be instances where airlines will discount to stimulate some traffic flow, but over time, it's inevitable that the high price of oil will be reflected in higher ticket prices.
In an interview for the BBC, he also suggested that unless alternative sources of fuel were found, there could be shortages over the summer months, but he ruled out widespread cancellations of flights. Children aged 8 years and over will be able to use passport e-gates at the UK border from this summer. The Home Office says the change will speed up checks for an extra 1.5 million young people each year. Simon Jones reports.
There are almost 300 e-gates designed to make border checks quicker for people from Britain and 38 other countries entering the UK. Currently, eligible children must be 10 years or over and accompanied by an adult to use them. But from July, the age will be lowered to 8. Though young people will need to be at least 3 feet 11 inches tall so they can be seen by the cameras. The Border Force says the change will free up officers to focus on intercepting people posing a threat to the UK. But checks for British travellers heading to the EU this summer may not be so smooth, with new digital verification already leading to long queues at some airports.
Two police forces in the south of England are trialling a new breathalyser to detect drivers who've taken laughing gas. Officers say the device could help prosecute people suspected of driving under the influence of the Class C drug nitrous oxide. Gigi Arne reports.
Police in Hampshire and the Thames Valley say the handheld device developed by scientists in Amsterdam can detect whether someone has inhaled nitrous oxide within the previous 2 hours. Results are then available within minutes. Nitrous oxide, also known as NOS or hippie crack, was made a Class C drug for unlawful use in 2023. Its use can cause unconsciousness and even neurological damage or death from suffocation. Police say they've already seen fatal crashes linked to its use behind the wheel, including a collision in Oxfordshire in which 3 teenage passengers died after the driver was filmed inhaling laughing gas moments before the crash.
Events are being held in Morecambe to celebrate what would have been the 100th birthday of one of the seaside town's most famous sons, the comedian Eric Morecambe. The BBC will mark the occasion by broadcasting a lost episode of Morecambe and Wise, which was recently found in a private collection, as Jane McCubbin reports.
Bring me fun, bring me sunshine. The unmistakable sound of Morecambe and Wise, the renowned TV double act. Their TV specials were a Christmas Day appointment to view in millions of homes for more than a decade from the late 60s. Eric Morecambe died of a heart attack in 1984, aged just 58. And in the seaside resort, which gave Eric Bartholomew his stage name, they're hosting events to celebrate what would have been his 100th birthday. And this evening, a long-lost episode of Morecambe and Wise, last seen in 1968, will be broadcast in his honour.
Good evening. Hey,
marvellous, huh?
Who came on then?
The episode is found in the estate of a former TV industry professional, restored by a charity and then returned to the BBC. And you can see it on BBC Four, and it's available on the iPlayer this evening from 8.
J. Jane McCubbin reporting.
Thank you for that. 8:10 is the time. What happens now? Angela Rayner, the former Deputy Prime Minister, has resolved, it seems, her troubles with the tax authorities. She is clear now to return to top politics. She's told The Guardian, when pressed by that newspaper on whether Keir Starmer should step down, Keir will have to reflect on that. It looks all but certain that the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, is going to resign and go for Keir Starmer's job. It also looks certain at the moment that Keir Starmer will not step down and will fight to stay in office. He's reported to have told ministers last night at a leadership contest would plunge us into chaos, as he put it. He wants to press ahead with the programme of measures that was set out, of course, in the King's speech yesterday. And this morning, the GDP figures for the first quarter of the year were stronger than expected, although, of course, the impact of the war in Iran has not yet been fully felt. There are still voices, though, today from within the Labour Party calling for more. The Labour Mayor of West Yorkshire, Tracy Braemin, talked to us just half an hour ago.
They have had 2 years, and now we need to make sure that the next 2 years are different, because we cannot continue as we have been, because we will not have the chance again, and we will have wasted the opportunity of a lifetime to have a Labour government.
Let us talk to James Murray, the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, who's in our Westminster studio and was listening to that. Good morning to you.
Hi, good morning.
Do you agree with her that there has to be something completely different now when it comes to the pace of change?
Well, look, Tracy's someone I work with really closely. We're good friends and good colleagues. And I think what I would take from the elections last week is that people are frustrated with not yet feeling in their lives the change that we promised. You know, I think I would take from the elections last week and all the conversations that I had that people support what we committed to doing. They're not turning against what we said we would do in the 2024 manifesto, but they want to feel that change. And so our focus as a government, you know, we're less than 2 years in. We've got another, you know, 3 years to the end of this parliament. Our focus has to be on making sure people can feel that change and see we're moving in the right direction.
So she's right. There has to be a completely different approach now to the one that has been for the last 2 years.
Well, I think if you look at what we've been doing a lot of changes that the Chancellor has put in place around stabilising.
Yeah, but she says it hasn't worked.
Well, no, but I think what has worked, as you've seen in terms of the GDP figures which are out this morning, is that we've had the right economic plan to stabilise the public finances and to put us in a stronger position. Now, look, we know that there are challenges ahead. We know that the war in Iran will have an impact on us. But I think we need to focus on what people are telling us they want us to do.
What she says that people are telling her they want done, for instance, is the nationalisation of the water industry in England.
Well, there is going to be a bill announced, which was announced in the King's speech yesterday, about improving water companies' regulation, about making
sure... That's exactly it, isn't it? That would be exactly her point. I think if she were here and talking honestly, she would say that's not enough. That precisely is the reason why, for instance, in her area, people voted Reform and kicked Labour out of Wakefield Council, etc., etc. They feel there are things that could be done that are not being done. It's too incremental. And what you set out in the King's speech, I think she would say, is still too incremental.
I disagree with that. I think if you look at some of the key measures in the King's speech, the Energy Independence Bill, which is about driving down energy costs for good. If you look at the transformation of the education system to improve education for children with SEND and for all pupils in schools. You know, if you look at what we're doing with the NHS and the improvement in the NHS over the last few years, if you look at what we've done in terms of our economic plan, the Chancellor's decisions, which have put us in a position where we have that strong economic growth that was announced this morning. You know, all of those are decisions that are putting us in a strong place as a country.
Why can't we nationalise water?
Is there water to? Of course there is.
Why can't we nationalise water? Because it's not just Tracy Braemin. There are quite a few Labour MPs who'd say the same thing and say that their constituents are telling them, do it.
Because our focus when it comes to water companies or any utilities is to improve the service that people get. Now, we need to do that in a way...
And that wouldn't come from nationalisation. Is that the point you're making? I mean, to take them on and tell them why they're wrong.
Well, look, nationalisation costs a huge amount of money. And the question we have to think, and I have to think, particularly in my role as Chief Secretary to the Treasury every turn, is how should public money be spent? How can we do the best for people? How can we deliver on what people want while spending public money in as wise as possible away. And nationalisation costs a lot of money. We can achieve a lot of things for people in terms of this service they receive from utilities through other mechanisms. But when it's the right thing to do, we will look at public ownership. Look at what we're doing with railways, bringing the contracts back into public ownership, making sure we've got Great British Railways set up. You know, we will be pragmatic about this, but we will always be focused on what experience do people have? How can we improve the quality of the service they get?
Do you not accept, though, that, and it comes from both the left and the right, that there is a boldness that is still lacking? So, for instance, there was nothing about welfare reform. There was no welfare bill, although it was something that you did tackle, of course, and tackled rather disastrously a year or so ago. There was nothing about social care. There is a sense that this government still thinks that it can get away with incrementalism in an age, and I think this would be the point that a lot of your councillors, particularly those who lost their seats, would make, in an age where that just doesn't wash.
I just don't agree with that characterisation of the King's speech yesterday or what we're doing as a government, because if you look at the focus on national security, on economic security, on energy security, these are the big questions which are facing people's lives. And with the Energy Independence Bill, with what we're doing on strengthening the economy, with what we're doing about boosting defence investment to the highest level since the Cold War, you know, this is about taking the big challenges that we face as a country head on. Now, are people feeling the benefits of the change that we're delivering yet? No, they're not. They're not feeling that enough. Absolutely. That was the feeling that I got on the doorsteps in the elections, and I know a lot of my colleagues did. But that is why we should be putting all of our energies toward delivering on people's priorities, all of our energies on the cost of living, on NHS waiting lists, on working internationally to get the Strait of Hormuz reopened. That's where all of our energy should go.
You mentioned the Energy Independence Bill, as it is called, which would ban, would it, the government, future governments as well, until they change the law, from issuing new licences to drill for oil and gas in the North Sea. And yet, of course, we import gas from Norway that's drilled in the North Sea. We import oil from the United States that is fracked, something that would also be banned by the Energy Independence Bill. It's an energy dependence bill, isn't it? More than anything else, dependent on other countries.
Well, the Energy Independence Bill is about making sure we can bring down bills for good by having homegrown sources of energy, new nuclear energy, renewable energy.
But we could have them anyway.
But
can't we do the both things? And this is what frustrates some people, as they do in China, as they do in India, as they do in the United States. Can we not both take out the resources from the earth that are there, but also enthusiastically and in the longer term, eventually, in a way that it'll mean they can take over, we go for renewables as well?
But we are doing both, Nick, because, you know, oil and gas plays a crucial role in our energy mix, and it will play a crucial role for decades to come. And what we want is to boost production.
No,
we
but hang
boost...
on, this bill does
can
less.
Can I make this point, Nick? Because we want to see tiebacks. Now, what a tieback is where we link production to existing
oil fields.
To
existing fields, yeah.
And that will boost the production, and that is a really important part
of our
energy mix.
We have talked about that before. I'm just saying what the Energy Independence Bill does is stop governments from issuing new licences, and that doesn't necessarily seem to improve our own energy independence.
Well, look, we've taken a position on new licences of new oil fields. And the truth is that if you started a whole new oil field now, it wouldn't deliver, you know, for a decade or longer. It wouldn't make a difference to the challenges people are facing
now. Nick Clegg used to say about nuclear power as well. You don't think far enough ahead. It will be the case, won't it, that oil is still part of the energy mix, and we will be importing oil into this country in a decade's time. In other words, that it is very short-sighted to ban yourself from doing something that might just help.
Well, oil and gas will both be a crucial part of our energy mix for years to come. I've explained how the tiebacks linking to existing fields is a way of boosting production. But that's why you mentioned nuclear. We are boosting the investment in new nuclear power in a way that hasn't been seen for decades in this country. And that's what we need to do to make sure we've got that energy independence. Because what we don't want to let be the case is just, you know, we get through what's happening in the Middle East now and just go back to business as usual. You talked about incremental change versus, you know, bold change. If we can get to a situation where we can say in a few years' time, you know what, We now have nuclear energy being built. We have solar, we have wind, we have energy independence to a degree that we haven't had in this country before. That means that we are more protected in the future. That protects businesses and families for anything in the future that comes our way.
Final thought about what's going on today, or indeed not going on today. When she's pressed, Angela Rayner, by The Guardian on whether Keir Starmer should step aside, she says Keir will have to reflect on that. Are you disappointed that she just didn't say, as I'm sure you would, I'm backing the Prime Minister?
Well, I think Angela also said in that interview that she wouldn't be triggering a leadership election. And I think that a leadership election would be the wrong choice for us to take. You know, I think it would bring huge instability. It would mean we would end up looking inward as a party when we should be focusing on the priorities for people across the country, as we've been talking about cost of living, NHS waiting lists, the international situation. And I think we have a responsibility to focus on what people want us to be delivering as a government.
Do you think Wes Streeting is still the health secretary at the moment?
He is the health secretary, and I hope he is the health secretary by the end of the day, because he's doing a really important job as health secretary. I work very closely with him as chief secretary to the Treasury on all of the improvements to the NHS, getting waiting lists down and A&E waiting lists, waiting times down.
Right. You know, so you're saying to him, even at this late stage, you're saying don't do it.
I would say to all colleagues, take a deep breath, take a step back, make sure that we recognise we're less than 2 years into this parliament. Look at what we've done so far. Look at the benefits of the stability that we've brought to government. Make sure that we don't go into a chaotic process of uncertainty, and make sure we focus on what people want us to be doing.
James Murray, Chief Secretary to the Treasury. Thank you.
It is 22 minutes past eight. President Trump and China's President Xi, leaders of the world's two biggest economies, have sat in talks for double the time expected at their long-awaited summit in Beijing. Before talks began, President Trump spoke of the significance of the meeting.
There are those that say this is maybe the biggest summit ever. They can never remember anything like it. It's, I can say in the United States, it's people aren't talking about anything else. But it's an honor to be with you. It's an honor to be your friend. And the relationship between China and the USA is going to be better than ever before.
Quite a lot of characteristic hyperbole there, but there was a lot to talk about. Trade, tariffs, high tech, but also big politics. Donald Trump wants China's help to end the standoff with Iran in the Strait of Hormuz. China and Iran are allies. The Iranian foreign minister was in Beijing just last week. China wanted to lean on the United States over support, military or otherwise, for Taiwan. And that last, we understand, led to some tension between the two leaders. Soon after their talks began, Chinese state media released comments by President Xi warning of potential conflict with the US over Taiwan. And then, as the two men toured the ancient site of the Temple of Heaven, side by side, dressed incredibly similarly, reporters asked three times if they had discussed Taiwan. The leader simply stared straight ahead and walked away. Well, Tom Bateman is our State Department correspondent. He's traveling with President Trump as part of the US lobby. And I asked what he knew about the Taiwan discussions, which are watched so anxiously by US allies in the region.
Well, all we have in terms of what was discussed in the talks so far are the readouts from the Chinese side. There's been nothing official from the White House. I'm travelling with the White House press pool. So, as you say, there's been a pretty clear message, I think, from the Chinese side that they pushed the issue of Taiwan. What Beijing wants there is basically for the Americans to hold off on a multi-billion dollar arms package, which still hasn't been approved to Taiwan. But no sense of whether or not President Xi was successful in one thing I think they want to try and get Donald Trump to do, which is basically to shift to a more explicit position opposing Taiwanese independence. I mean, the White House said in the run-up to this trip that there would be no change in the policy on Taiwan. So nothing clear on that. And as for the sort of broader issues here, I mean, what's clear is that President Trump needs a favour from the Chinese leader here, particularly when it comes to the considerable leverage he could exert over Tehran when it comes to reopening the Strait of Hormuz.
Absolutely. What have you heard about that? Because China is a close ally of Iran's.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it was President Trump was contradictory in the run-up to this. The night before he flew, he said both that they will talk for a long time about Iran, but then said, well, there's nothing to talk about when it comes to Iran because we're in control of the situation. I mean, clearly it will have been a big part of these discussions, which lasted more than 2 hours. In terms of whether or not Mr. Trump was able to get Beijing to do anything on that, I think if there is some movement there, clearly there would be the expectation from Beijing of a quid pro quo. So what are the Americans going to shift on? That could be on trade. It could be on Taiwan. And as I say, we don't know what the Americans are going to say about that yet.
Well, let's look at trade, because Donald Trump brought with him the CEOs of 30 major tech businesses to Beijing, hoping China would open its doors to more American firms. I mean, you do get behind the scenes access by traveling with President Trump. What's been the tone and the hope of those CEOs?
I mean, it was a totally surreal moment, to be honest with you, Katya. We came through the Great Hall of the People to this extraordinary scene, looking across Tiananmen Square, Chinese troops there with weapons all standing in line as President Trump turned up to be welcomed by President Xi. There was a gun salute for him echoing across that square. I could feel it, you know, these huge echoes, incredibly loud. And behind him, lined up on the steps, were the top executives of American companies, including Elon Musk, the world's richest man, and a number of others, including his own son, Eric, who co-runs the Trump Organization, which has interests here. So you've got this feeling that this was both about, you know, clearly the optics of what Mr. Trump wants to achieve when it comes to American investment, American trade, and its rivalry with China, but also to do deals. And there was a meeting between some of those executives and the Chinese leader after the bilateral with Mr. Trump. As for what was done, we saw Elon Musk actually after he came out and tried to shout some questions to him about whether he got what he wanted, but he wasn't answering that at that stage.
Because there are lots of concerns about intense rivalry from China. But what about back home? President Trump is really under pressure from low opinion poll ratings. His base does not like the war in Iran. And of course, you know, inflation going up as a result. What specifically is being discussed on trade that might appeal to the MAGA base?
I mean, a couple of big things there. I think one is on the sales of soybeans, which will help American farmers. The other is on these, you know, other sales that Mr. Trump wants to do, investment into the American economy, which is why he's basically brought all these executives with him.
Tom Bateman, thank you so much.
And that was Katya talking to Tom Bateman. It brings us to 28 minutes past eight and to the sport, which comes this morning from Jane Dougal. Morning, Jane.
Morning, Justin. A highly controversial VAR decision could have impacted the outcome of the Scottish Premiership. Last night, Hearts, who have been top of the league for most of the season, could have won the title with a victory over Falkirk and if rivals Celtic had lost their match against Motherwell. However, a questionable late penalty was awarded to Celtic, which gave them a 3-2 win in the 99th minute and ensures that the title race will go to the final day of the season when they host Hearts at Parkhead. Yesterday, we spoke to former Celtic midfielder Peter Grant. This morning, we are joined by former sporting director at Hearts, Joe Savage. Welcome, Joe. A lot of anger from non-Celtic fans about the VAR decision. What did you think?
Do you know, Jane, when I was watching the game last night, I couldn't see how they could have given the penalty. I couldn't see for the life of me. I've started to watch a few videos this morning, and the hand's clearly closer to the head than I thought, but I'm still of the opinion that I don't think it's a penalty. I don't think it's such a big moment in a game that you can give that as a penalty. But again, I would never want to be a referee. I would never want to be in that position. So, yeah, it's a hard, hard one, that.
Well, just to explain as well, Motherwell's Sam Nicholson had gone up for a high ball and replays seemed to show it hitting either his head or his hand or together, and a handball was given, and that's why there was a penalty awarded to Celtic. There is now just 1 point between the two sides. If Celtic win on Saturday, they win the league, so Hearts need to win or draw. How tough is that going to be, Joe, especially at Parkhead?
Yeah, I think it'll be very difficult for them, but Hearts are unbeaten against Celtic this season for a reason. So they've clearly been hard to beat. They're top of the league on merit. They're at the moment, they're the best team in the league. And they'll go there on Saturday with great confidence. I think Derek McInnes will have them really well organised. You've seen it last night in his interviews. He was talking about a siege mentality. They think everyone's against them. So that could play into their hands to say, right, we just make sure we do not get beat. Because, Jane, that's all they need to do. They just don't need to get beat. They don't need to win the game. Celtic need to win the game. Hearts just don't need to get beat. And I think come Saturday, there could be a great chance that Hearts don't do that. They just stay in the game. They do what they need to do. And they probably pick up the point, which is all they need.
You weren't at the club when Derek McInnes was appointed manager, but what do you feel he's brought to the side? How has he managed to keep them at the top of the league for so long, breaking the dominance of the old firm?
I think he's a throwback. He's a proper leader. He's a proper character. He understands the culture and the environment in Scotland. He knows exactly how to get the best out of these players. He maintains that sort of attitude towards his football, the way he wants to play, the way they want to go about their business. They're so hard to play against, they're so hard to beat, and they never know when they're beaten. And it's a great quality to have. And I think that looking at Derek McInnes' teams over the years, he's always shown that. And I think, listen, it's turned out to be a brilliant appointment for Hearts, getting Derek McInnes in.
We saw the Brighton owner, Tony Bloom, watching on last night at Tynecastle. He has made a substantial investment into Hearts. So how much do you credit him for this season's success?
I think, listen, he's played a huge part, hasn't he? They've signed a lot of players, players that have made impacts for them. But again, last night was really, it was really good for me, having been the ex-sporting director at the club, that the three players that scored the goals last night were all signed under my regime. So that was pleasing. I took pride in that. But listen, you can't take away from what Tony's done, the investment that they've made, and obviously they've brought in Derek McInnes, and Bragg is obviously player of the year. They've done really, really well. So it's just been a marriage made in heaven, hasn't it, the way it's all worked out for them.
There certainly seems to be a fantastic atmosphere around the club. Where are you going to be on Saturday? How are you going to be watching this match, from behind the couch?
Yeah, probably just in the house. Just I've got a few things on, but I'll just probably watch it in my living room just to see how it goes. But yeah, I'll be watching intensely to see who can come out on top.
All right, Joe Savage, former sporting director at Hearts, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us. The huge match on Saturday, which will determine the outcome of the Scottish Premiership, will be covered across the BBC.
Thank you, Jane. In our time is coming up just after nine, let's hear from Misha Glennie with the details.
Good morning. It'd be fair to say that the Sahara Desert might not be the most hospitable place to live, but around 2,000 years ago, an ancient people thrived there, known to us as the Garamantes. They used to be seen as tribal nomads, but in recent decades, the detective work of archaeologists has revealed something rather different. The Garamantes built cities, vast underground irrigation systems, and more than held their own in trade with the Roman Empire. That's the Garamantes, with David Mattingly, Faris Moussa and Josephine Quinn on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds just after 9 a.m. And now back to the Today studio.
And it is 27 minutes to 9. You are listening to Today on Radio 4. Catch your idler Justin Webb and Jane Steele with the news.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has spoken about the prospect of a Labour leadership contest for the first time. She told the BBC that Labour MPs have an important decision to make and warned a contest would plunge the country into chaos. Allies of the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, say they expect him to challenge the Prime Minister in the coming hours. It's unclear if he has the support of 81 MPs required. The former Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, has arrived in Downing Street shortly after announcing she'd settled her tax affairs with HMRC. It means she could now enter a potential race to become the next Labour leader. The latest official figures show that the UK economy grew by 0.6% in the first 3 months of the year, which is better than had been predicted. There was a rebound in areas including retail, the wholesale trade and construction. In the past half hour, the Metropolitan Police have said a second man has been charged with arson in relation to a recent attack on a former synagogue in East London. 31-year-old Dominic Charles Turner is due before magistrates later today.
Thank you, Jane. It is gone 34 minutes past eight. And of course, we can't ignore the swirl of rumours, the anticipation today around a possible challenge or challenges to Keir Starmer as Prime Minister. But after the disastrous showing for Labour in last week's local election in England and votes for the devolved parliaments in Scotland and Wales, the Prime Minister gave a defiant speech on Monday where he vowed to bring the UK back to the heart of Europe, laying out a platform, he said, on which the UK can build tighter links with the EU as part of the government's efforts to boost the economy. In the King's speech yesterday, we heard more about the European Partnership Bill, which will contain controversial powers to fast-track legislation to deliver a series of new agreements planned with the EU. Well, Sandro Gozzi is an Italian politician who serves as an MEP in a French constituency for the Democratic Movement Party. He chairs the European side of the EU-UK Parliamentary Partnership Assembly, and he joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Gozzi, I'm wondering what you think when you heard from Keir Starmer that he wants to bring the UK back to the heart of Europe. How is that possible when the Labour manifesto says there will be no freedom of movement, no return to an EU customs union, no return to the single market? How close to the heart can you then get?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think you should ask the Prime Minister which path he wants to follow. From our perspective and looking at his speech, there are many things that can be done very soon. I mean, he talks about electricity, trade, some standard for consumer protection, phytosanitary standard. All this is being negotiated, and I hope that after the speech of the Prime Minister, the negotiation will intensify and we can deliver by the EU-UK summit, the second EU-UK summit, which should be held in Brussels at the beginning of July. So there is a part of the speech of your Prime Minister, which I would call, could be of fast delivery. Okay. Then there is a strategic perspective he mentioned. And in my view, the strategic perspective, from our perspective, should be to aim to be associated to the single market and to be one of the leading on the founder of a new European Security Council, of a new European Security Architecture that we have to organize in the continent after the end of the war in Ukraine. So these are two major political objectives.
Mr. Gozzi, if I can go bit by bit, because we have heard big words, warm words from the Prime Minister, from the Chancellor about getting close to the EU. But you mentioned the approaching EU-UK summit at the second after Brexit. Yeah. The first was held just over a year ago. Yeah. But actually, we're talking about limited agreements here, aren't we? We're talking about a youth experience scheme. We're talking about a kind of food and drink safety agreement, the so-called SBS agreement. And we're talking about carbon emissions. That is it. You mentioned electricity, and the government is interested in getting energy security for the United Kingdom. But these negotiations haven't even started yet. And when they do, the EU has been clear to the UK they have to pay to play. In this case, they're asking for the UK to contribute to the EU budget.
Well, I mean, this is happens for every member state, for every non-member state, then to want to participate to some common policy in the EU. It's not a special request for UK. All those who want to have a special trade or environmental, ecological relationship with the single market, they must also contribute. This is true for UK, as it is true for Norway, as it is true for Iceland, as it is true for other associated countries. So I don't see that as a problem. It's not the UK contribution the problem. In my perspective, first of all, I mean, on this we can go very fast. And I wouldn't say they are that limited because, I mean, talking about the electricity market, talking about a convergence on the climate change strategies, because we are talking about this, they are quite pretty bold step in our relationship. But in my view,
the political point
that you should ask is not the detail of this negotiation, but please.
Yes, please. I'm very sorry to interrupt you. From the EU side, I always hear this welcomeness for the UK. Come back as close as you want. However, there is always a cost, whether it's a financial cost, as we were discussing for electricity, or the closer you get to the single market, if you go sector by sector closer and closer, the more the EU wants from the UK or any other third country, as you say. If you take the example of Norway, which you mentioned, if you have the free freedom in trade terms, freedom in services terms between the EU and a third country, there's also an expectation of the freedom of movement. And currently, that's a red line for the government.
Once again, it's up to your government. The single market is made up of four freedoms. One of these four freedoms is free movement. It is clear that the UK, with all the respect for the democratic referendum and vote, made a major economic and historical mistake in leaving the EU. And you are paying the consequence today of leaving the EU. And the fact that most of the public opinion regret Brexit, it showed that also the public opinion, not the expert about international politics, realize the damages that your economy is suffering from Brexit. So the issue, in my view, from our perspective, in the speech of your Prime Minister, is how we can recover the damages. And for me, if we want to switch to another dimension, the two issues are this one. I mean the association to the single market and security. I insist on security because security means also defend the industry, means also to participate to the development of European defense industry, which is very interesting from both the security perspective and the economic perspective. It is clear
indeed,
that if you ask me, the red lines are 2 centuries ago. I mean, did we see what happened since the red lines?
No. Sandro Gozzi, thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed for your time. And indeed, security is probably the first point where relations between the EU and the UK began to get a lot warmer after the bitter days of the Brexit negotiations. Thank you.
19 minutes to nine. Just before we let that subject go, Katya, it's frustrating, isn't it? Because there is this sense that there are moments, there are deals that can be done, etc. But for a government that wants here to be seen to be acting boldly, none of it feels very bold. It's really interesting talking to the Chief Secretary to Treasury and indeed to Tracy Brabin, the Mayor of West Yorkshire, earlier on in the programme. All the demands are for boldness. So if you look at the European stuff, boldness would involve, I don't know, saying our aim is to be back at the single market, or at least the customs union, etc., etc. All of that is ruled out by the government at the moment. And these deals, they're all there to be done potentially, but it just doesn't feel as if it's anything that people are going to be able to say here in Britain, here we are, now we've got something, this is it, this is progress.
Yeah, I agree. It's not just that it's not being said, it's not being felt, because I think if you have a look ahead at this summit that we expect in a few weeks' time, as I said, it's about youth mobility, it's about food and drink. So there are many farmers who welcome the food and drink agreement, and for youngsters and giving them more opportunities abroad, which is something that the Prime Minister has spoken about, they might welcome that as well. But these are narrow sectors, if you like. This is not going to move the dial on the UK economy as a whole. And you're right, in order to have that bold move, in order to really feel a difference across the economy, then yeah, you would have to rejoin the single market or form a customs union with the EU. But then that takes us back to Brexit as it is, with new legislation being brought in that was mentioned in the King's speech to make it easier to just adopt EU legislation into UK law as part of agreements. There's a reform, the Conservatives saying this is reversing Brexit through the back door. So, there may be visions, but there are also political constraints. And of course, the fact that Sir Keir Starmer at the moment is politically in trouble. So privately, what I'm hearing from European diplomats and players is they can keep negotiating with the government, which they are. But will this still be the same government come, a week, months from now? And therefore, how much does it hold going forward?
Just to be clear, if you go all the way to being part of the single market again, then that means complete freedom of movement.
It's freedom of movement. Yeah, they call it the indivisible freedoms. And so you look at Norway, for example. So Norway is part of the European Economic Area. It's called the EEA, but it's part of the single market, basically. But you'll hear them complaining because they are payers, not players, because it means they have to accept a lot of EU rules, including freedom of movement, and they don't really have any choice in it. There are voices who say, because of all these big things going on geopolitically and the important role that the UK is playing. You know, we have played a leadership role when it comes to Ukraine. We are out there with the French and trying to orchestrate this international maritime force in the Strait of Hormuz to help safeguard the movement of vessels after that the conflict is over potentially. So since the UK is such an important partner to European neighbours, there are those who say that they should show more flexibility to the UK. But at the moment, I don't see those rules being bent on either side.
OK, time is 9:15.
It is 9:15, and it's the head of the global airlines trade body, the International Air Transport Association, has warned that high flight prices could continue into next year, even if the Strait of Hormuz were to open tomorrow, which there seems no sign of happening. Willie Walsh, who used to run British Airways and later became chief executive of its owner, IAG, has been speaking to our transport correspondent, Theo Leggett.
The principal concern really relates to the fact that the UK does not have a lot of refining capacity for the size of the economy, and actually imports about 78% of its jet fuel requirements. So quite a significant amount of that, about 34%, comes from Kuwait. And Kuwait has not exported anything since the war really started. So the concern will be whether the UK can source alternate supply of refined jet fuel.
What we've seen so far is that prices on long-haul flights have gone up quite considerably, and we've seen fuel surcharges and so on. In Europe, prices have gone the other way a little bit because it seems people aren't willing to travel, so airlines are trying to encourage them back. Do you see that as a very short-term thing? Are prices bound to go up in Europe as well?
Yeah, I think it's inevitable. You know, given that if you look at it at an industry-wide level, fuel will represent, I suspect, around 40% of the cost base this year. When you consider that airline margins are in the order of 3 to 4% at a net level, there's just no way that the airlines can absorb the additional costs that they're experiencing. So ultimately, the consumer will end up seeing higher fares. There may be instances where airlines will discount to stimulate some traffic flow. Given that the flights will operate, they'll want to maximize the number of people on those flights. So you may see some tactical pricing options being used by airlines as we go through the summer period. But over time, as I said, it's inevitable that the high price of oil will be reflected in higher ticket prices.
And is this going to be a long-term thing? I mean, if the Strait of Hormuz were reopened tomorrow, would we then see prices coming back down again?
I think it's likely to continue for some months to come yet. So even if it opened tomorrow, the disruption to the supply of crude, some damage to refining facilities, the disruption to the refined product, all of these issues will take time to resolve. So whichever way you look at it, I think this issue will continue for a number of months to come and may indeed continue into next year.
And that was Willie Walsh, the boss of airline body IATA, speaking to Theo Leggett. Well, joining me now is our very own Sean Farrington, our business presenter. Hi, Sean.
Hello, Katya.
So, you know, a lot of people are, I mean, the weather's miserable, isn't it? A lot of us are thinking about, I am thinking about sunshine, I have to admit. We're thinking about summer holidays, maybe thinking about having to take a flight for those summer holidays. On the one hand, we were hearing there from Willie Walsh about tactical pricing from airlines, you know, wanting to make sure that their planes are full. But on the other hand, about possible price rises for months to come. What should we make of all this? What should we expect?
It is confusing, isn't it? I mean, actually, I should say the sun is out over the piazza in Salford today. Getting the deck chairs will be out there later.
I should be with you.
It's always an option, Katya. You're always
we don't need
welcome.
To fly anywhere, Sean, really, do we?
No.
Frankly?
Well, customer habits, they're starting to change like that. We're having those conversations again. We're hearing from the holiday companies that, you know, staycations may be considered a little bit more, that there's been a shift in demand, certainly from Eastern Mediterranean destinations to Western Mediterranean destinations. TUI literally reflecting that in its financial results this week. They have seen a 10% fall in the sales of its summer holiday bookings made by Brits this year because of the caution. So for all of the airlines talking, maybe as they were a few weeks ago when we were all watching the price pressures from the Middle East play out and see jet fuel in particular, what would happen next? We heard a lot of the airlines then talk about how there would perhaps be upward price pressure the way Willie Walsh is talking about now. But they then had to react to how customers were behaving. That caution was kicking in. And as we've heard relentlessly from a lot of airlines and holiday companies, that you don't need to cancel. There is no imminent jet fuel shortage around Europe. But clearly there was a bit of a disconnect with their customers there. So we have seen those prices come down. And what Willie Walsh is reflecting there is that he thinks that's not sustainable if prices stay as high as they are and the longer term questions about jet fuel supply still linger.
That's right. So, Sean, just very briefly, because, you know, we heard from a government spokesperson who said the same as you, know, there's not currently a shortage of jet fuel, but we have no idea, of course, when the blockade on the Strait of Hormuz will end. So is there a particular point when, you know, prices will go up? And would you say it'd be particular routes? Just briefly, if you would. Sorry, Sean.
Long-haul flights are already seeing significant increases. So people will see that. Short-haul, it's probably a lot linked to customer demand. And Willie Walsh highlighting in that interview that July and August for the UK in particular is when there's a big increase in flights and fuel requirements. So that will be one for the airlines to watch around then.
Sean Farrington, thank you very much.
And that brings us to 10 to 9 from today. People all over the UK are going to be able to participate in a collective digital portrait. The portrait is by Es Devlin. It's at the National Portrait Gallery. Both of us, Katya and I, have both taken part. We've uploaded our photos already by phone, and it's a very easy process, I can tell you. It's then rendered into a drawing in the style of Es Devlin, and you can leave it there, or indeed you can get rid of it. And if you leave it there, it'll be in a bigger national portrait, writ large, which they're putting on. So, Es Devlin is here in the studio. And so is Chloe Barnes, who does portraits the old way, known for winning the Sky Portrait Artist of the Year, but also being commissioned by the Royal Society for a portrait of Hannah Fry. And she also teaches drawing as well. So good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Es, first of all, what's the purpose of it? What have you been trying to achieve?
It came from the title. We have a National Portrait Gallery. It's one of the largest portrait galleries in the world with over 220,000 artworks in it. We are co-owners of that. It's held in trust for the people of the United Kingdom. It has always been a mirror of us. What if we could have a national portrait, a portrait of us, that redrew itself every time somebody took part? All 55 million adults in the UK can be part of this portrait and see their own face up in a big picture in the same room as portraits of the King and Queen, Anna Wintour, Marcus Rashford. You're up there. You and Katya are already up there on the wall right now. It's reimagining national identity as a collective act of imagination.
And Katya, I've got yours on my phone here. Yours looks fantastic. Are you pleased with it? Does it capture you?
It's got a much posher nose than I have, I think. I think it has a posh. But I, what I love about this project, I mean, my daughter was killing herself laughing while I was trying to get my face inside, you know, the sort of space where you need to sort of take your picture. So it's a lot of fun as well. But I think it's really nice that everybody can be a part of it, because sometimes with art there can be a sense, or galleries, you know, these big imposing galleries that that not everybody feels it's their cup of tea. But if we're all part of the cup of tea, I rather like that idea.
Does it pose a threat, Chloe, to you?
Not. I wouldn't say so, actually. And I was reading a lot about Es's exhibition coming up, and I like the idea that this kind of like portrait is so collaborative, and actually it allows people to come in who might not be artists and take part in something that will exist and be a part of history. But I think that, like, as a more traditional artist, like, these portraits can exist side by side.
Yeah, so it's a different thing. It's a new thing. The fact that this is AI, essentially, or that AI has a big part to play in it, doesn't worry you, because what you do will still exist separately. I mean, I suppose the obvious analogy is photographs and art anyway. I mean, when photography came along, it didn't kill art.
No, absolutely. And this is like a different rendering of a portrait, and each portrait will be different. And AI can seem like this really scary thing, but Es is using it as a tool and as a way to create imagery, but with consent of, like, everybody that takes part. So I think consent and collaboration is a big thing.
Es?
Yes. When I make portraits, which, as you know, I made 50 portraits in 2024 of London's refugee community. I actually made a portrait of the mayor of Kyiv, Vitali Klitschko, recently. When I make a portrait, it's up to me when it's finished and what it looks like. The sitter might not like it. In this case, it's up to every member of the British public to decide how they look in this portrait. We have so many instances of this technology being used to extract from us, to divide us, to separate us, to isolate us. And as artists, this is an act of resistance to that separation and distraction.
Doesn't it also persuade us to be as narcissistic as we can possibly be? Because, Holb, you just said, when you do a portrait, you have to live with what you are saying by the portrait. This is part of, you could argue, I suppose, part of a kind of social media age where we make ourselves as perfect as we possibly can, and we're not.
Do you know what happens each time we move from your portrait to Katya's portrait, to the portrait of Ravinder, who's one of the people who works at the National Portrait Gallery, to the portrait of Norman Foster, who took part in it? There is a merging. There's a merging between faces from one to the next, and none of us get to control that. Mm. We're all in this country together. Let's all be in this portrait together, united.
And it's such a wonderful thing. Is that there is something, isn't there, Chloe, about particularly portrait art, whether it's AI art or the art that you do or whatever it is, that can capture something that nothing else, well, that a photograph doesn't, I suppose.
Yeah, so, I mean, with my sort of portrait, there's a lot with the handmade mark and kind of that way of expression and emotion and psychology that can come through within a portrait. What I think is great about Ez is that, like, her drawing and her style is kind of at the centre of this, and it's taken it away from something just being a photograph and then transformed into something else.
Ez, how do people do it? If they want to take part, what do they do?
Go to the National Portrait Gallery website. Also, we are offering a lot of drawing classes. Today, if you're free, come at 3 p.m. and 4 p.m. I will be offering portrait drawing classes, free materials, free to all, and they're running right throughout the six-month run. We are encouraging people to make marks with pencil, paint, chalk, charcoal. This is not an alternative. It's an addition.
Ez Devlin, Chloe Barnes as well. Thank you both.
It's 3 minutes to nine later this morning on Radio 4. Armando Iannucci asked whether a make or break speech really can make a politician. In strong message here, that's at 9:30.
And talking of make or break speeches, at 3 minutes to nine, let us turn to Chris Mason, not because he's about to make a speech, but because if there have been any speeches, he will be aware of them. Morning again, Chris. What's happening or not happening?
Morning. The joy of the theatre of the mind of radio is I can't work out if those portraits were sort of, you know, works of genius or gargoyles or quite what.
I'm not saying anything about mine.
Nice little diversion for me for 90 seconds or so. So things moving fast, Justin. Clearly this intervention at 6 o'clock this morning from Angela Rayner, the former Deputy Prime Minister, saying she's resolved her tax issues. She's willing to play her part in any leadership race. Then, I think strikingly, in terms of the Prime Minister's defenders, the Chancellor Rachel Reeves appearing on BBC Breakfast in the last hour, talking about the chaos for the country if there is a leadership race. We await any move from Wes Streeting, the health secretary. Does he have the numbers? His critics suggesting he might not. His team dismissing that in the last few days as spin. So we're into that zone where things are moving hour by hour, and each camp is then responding publicly to the interventions of other camps. All of this within a government that is also seeking to outwardly look as functional as possible.
Yeah. I mean, if Wes Streeting decides not to do it, that in itself would be extraordinary now, isn't it? And newsworthy and damaging to him.
Well, even if he was decided not to do it today, because I think such as the momentum that has built up and the expectation amongst his supporters and those who are very keen to see him do it, that if we get through another day where he doesn't, then the clamour of voices that are already there saying variations of, you know, he's a bottler, he doesn't have the money, he doesn't have the numbers, he doesn't have the gumption, etc., etc., all critiques that his team vigorously dispute, those noises will get louder and louder and louder. So it's very live, and the momentum can swing significantly within just a couple of hours in terms of the psychology of this, with expectation building and then ebbing away, different camps thinking they've had a good few hours only for it to swing back in a different direction. It will be a lively day and an interesting day, whatever does or doesn't happen.
Yep. Okay, well, look, Chris, thank you. We'll let you get on with your day.